All right. Whoa, this is a hot mic. Good morning. Yes, of course, April. Now that April's here, we can begin. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to QQ. So for those who don't know me, my name's Nina Waters. I serve as the chair for QQ. Thank you for being here from traveling near and far. And I want to thank Anna and Tori for all their work in helping support QQ and putting together a really wonderfully full agenda for today. So we will get started this morning with just introductions. So we'll pass the mic around the room. You can introduce yourself, the organization you're from. And then let's do an icebreaker because we've got some time to kill. What's your favorite summer activity? So feel free to share that with us. Just know that the microphones, the way that the hybrid meeting works is that we need to use the microphones in order for those online to be able to hear us. So please just be patient and grab the mic whenever you have something to say. And a couple other housekeeping out right outside. We've got some snacks and things like that. Bathrooms are right around the corner. There's another bank of bathrooms down back by the entrance if you go down the hallway. And any other housekeeping that I'm missing, Anna? No? Okay, great. So we'll just pass it around. Gusty, you want to start?
Sure, Gusty Kanakis with the Town of Minturn on Town of Minturn Town Council. Oh, favorite activity is probably snowmobiling in the wintertime.
I'm John Doyle. I'm an Aspen City Council, and favorite summer activity is getting out in the mountains.
Oh, it's my turn. Gear up.
I'm Gary Brooks with the town of Avon. I'm a council member. I'm also the vice president of the Eagle River Coalition, a local watershed group. And my favorite summer activity is volunteering for nonprofits.
And fishing.
Hi, my name is Marina LaVarne. I am the water quality intern with the town of Vail this year. My favorite summer activity would be hiking and then also eating peach pie.
My name's Pete Wadden. I'm the watershed health specialist with Town of Vail. I think I would say my favorite activity is kayaking.
Jessica Otoro with Ellery Water. I'm also on the board for the Eagle River Coalition, like Gary here. And my favorite activity is camping with my dogs.
So, Stephen Wilson with the Town of Eagle, the utility manager for water and wastewater. And I think the favorite summer activity would be hiking with dogs.
I'm Josh Rumble, Director of Watershed Restoration at Eagle River Coalition, and my favorite summertime activity would be fishing, which Gary lied about because it's his too.
Good morning. My name is Tom Gazarovsky. I'm the Public Works Director at the Town of Eagle, and my favorite thing to do in the summer is hike and get up in the mountains.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Laura Belanger with Western Resource Advocates, and I like to stand up paddleboard when it's really hot out, and I'm going to throw hiking in there too.
Good morning. My name is Ann Castle. I'm with the Getches Wilkinson Center at the University of Colorado. And my favorite thing to do in the summer is hike around mountain trails and eat corn on the cob.
Hi, Greg Poshman, Pitkin County Commissioner. I'm the vice chair this year for QQ, and I'm pretty much hydrophilic.
PJ Murray with the City of Aspen. My favorite summer activity is mountain biking.
Hi, everyone. I'm April Long. I'm the executive director of the Rudai Water and Power Authority, and I enjoy overnight rafting.
My name is Bill Hobletzel. I work here with the Eagle River Coalition. And yeah, I like to be in my kayak, mountain bike, whatever's good that day.
Hi, my name is Katie Reesberg. I am a sustainability intern at the town of Breckenridge, and my favorite summer activity would be mountain biking.
Good morning, all. I'm Cliff Cross. I'm a planner for the town of Breckenridge. One of my favorite summer activities, other than recreating in our lovely backyards, is enjoying a nice patio with some lemonade.
Hi, my name is Chelsea Lang. I'm the Public Works Director with Copper Mountain Metro District. My favorite summertime activity is whatever my four-year-old wants to do.
Hi, I'm Heather Allen with High Country Conservation Center in Summit County. My favorite summertime activity is anything outdoors with my dog, so mountain biking, stand-up paddleboarding, whatever.
Good morning, Callie Rand, Eagle County Natural Resource Manager, and my favorite summer activity is listening to live music in the parks.
Good morning, my name is Troy Wineland. I'm the Water Commissioner for the Blue River Basin. Too many favorite activities to choose from, but the short list is mountain biking, backpacking, and hiking and running herd of my water users.
Hi, my name is Scott O'Brien with the Town of Dillon. My favorite summer activity is trail running.
Hi, I'm Commissioner, County Commissioner Laura Puckett Daniels from Gunnison County, and that's my job. And my favorite summer activity is mountain biking.
Hi, I'm Ashley Bembenek, Water Quality Specialist for QQ and a member of our contract team. And my favorite summertime activity is also mountain biking. Must be why we call Gunnison County home.
We'll make you walk.
Good morning, Scott Kalman. I'm Director of Environmental Health for Rock County. And mountain biking, definitely one. And also been playing a lot of disc golf, which my dog also loves.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Kaylee Folk. I'm the Water Quality Specialist for Grand County, and my favorite summer activity is stand-up paddleboarding on the rivers and getting on overnights as well, and also mountain biking, too.
Morning, Anna Drexler-Dreis. I'm with QQ, and I enjoy gardening in the summer.
Good morning. Eva Wilson, Director of Engineering for the Town of Avon. I enjoy hiking in the summer.
And I'm Jeremy Reitman. I'm the town manager for Town of Gypsum. And honestly, if I could just ski all year, I would. But I did ski on June 8th, so.
I'm Emily Lowell. I'm with the Upper Yampa Water Conservancy District. And my favorites are probably mountain biking and trail running.
Hi, I'm Laura Hartman, Senior Policy Analyst for Eagle County Government. And in the summer, I like to 50-50 trail run mountain bike. And if you can do a multi-sport day, that's the best day.
Hi, I'm Tom Boyd, Eagle County Commissioner. I'm going to say all the same things you do, but this summer my favorite thing has been staying cool in the Eagle County building while we work on our geothermal project that is going to keep us all cool for many, many years to come in the Eagle County building. It's just not doing it yet. So we're warm in there. I think that's it, right? A week back to Nina.
Good to see you.
Oh, good to see you, Dom. All right. So we're going to go to the folks online. I'll be calling you out as I see you guys. So we'll start with Tori.
Hi, good morning, everybody. Sorry not to be with you in person, but I'm Tori Jarvis. Barbara Green and I are with the firm Sullivan Green CV. I think she's online too now. She'll be dropping on and off. I'll be mostly here today. And I'm part of the consultant team that, that staffs QQ. Favorite summertime activity. I like the hydrophilic, word. I didn't know that word, Greg, but anything water, stand up paddleboarding, rafting, all sorts of good stuff.
Agreed. Okay. Let's move on to Julie Baxter.
Hi. I'm Julie with the City of Steamboat Springs. I'm the Water Resources Manager, and I love hiking and backpacking in the summertime.
Wonderful, Julie. Thanks. We've got next, I've got Abigail.
Hi, I'm Abby Tejan from the Copper Mountain Metro District. I am our district manager. And my favorite summer activity is biking, any shape or form, mountain, gravel, road.
Barbara.
Hi, I'm Barbara Green. As Tori said, we're both with Sullivan Green CV. This is the third QQ meeting that I've missed since 1987. not to be there in person. It feels pretty weird, and it's a wonderful turnout. My favorite summer activity is anything outside, anything at all, and just happy to see everybody in the room.
We miss you, Barbara. It's an impressive track record. Ed, I have next on my...
Hi, Ed Regner, Grand County, and it'd be a toss-up between mountain biking and sitting on my boat in Grand Lake.
Love that. Next, I have Elle, or Ellie.
Hi, yep. My name is Elle. I am the aide to Colorado House Speaker McCluskey, who I'm sure many of you know. She represents six mountain counties, including Grand, Jackson, Summit, Lake, Park, and Chaffee counties. So definitely some pretty amazing parts of the state, some of my favorite places as well. I'm happy to be here. This is my first QQ. I wish I could be there in person, but I'm excited to be here online at least. And my favorite summer activity is probably trail running.
Thanks, Al. Next, I've got Kathy.
Hi, everyone. Kathy Chandler Henry, a former Eagle County Commissioner and a current member of the Colorado River District Board, listening in this morning. Favorite summer activity is hiking and being on the top of a mountain and looking out at beautiful Colorado.
Thanks, Kathy. I have next Kristen Green.
Hi, my name's Kristen Green, no relation to Barbara. I'm here mostly as just an interested party. I'm currently wrapping up a PhD and have done a lot of research around kind of water projects and impacts to the headwater counties. And I used to work with the QQ consultant team while I was at Conservation Colorado. So I'm here to just mostly learn about the work folks are doing, and thank you and appreciate the offer. Oh, favorite activity. I really love gardening and then, you know, canning said garden fare.
Yeah. Love that, Kristen. Welcome. Next I have Lisa.
Yes. Good morning, everybody. Lisa Tasker. I'm with the Picken County Healthy Rivers Program. And my favorite summertime activity is all of the above, I think, but definitely hiking and biking, and right now gaining as much elevation as possible when we start to heat up. So nice to see you all.
It's a wise move. Next, I have Lynn. Maybe Lynn's away from her monitor at the moment, but last but certainly not least, Randy.
Good morning, everyone. Randy George, Grand County Commissioner. And boy, I've been trying to think about the favorite summer activity, and I'm having a hard time getting beyond zooming into a QQ meeting on a gorgeous day. But with that said, really horseback riding in the high country with my daughter, Hannah.
Yeah, sorry to take you away from this lovely day. I mean, it will be riveting, Randy. Great. And of course, my favorite summer activity is being outside. But I hold a very special place in my heart for rivers. So next we have on our agenda, Anne. So Anne will be kind of giving us a presentation on back to basics and the negotiations going on during the Colorado River. So you got a microphone, it's on mute. Take it away, Barbara, Anne, whenever you're ready.
Okay, I think I'm ready. This is working, yes? Okay. Cool. And I have a clicker. So a little background on me. I'm a water wonk, probably like a lot of you. I am a lawyer. I practiced water law in Denver for almost 30 years. And then I was privileged to go into the Obama administration, the Department of the Interior, working with Ken Salazar as the Assistant Secretary for Water and Science, and got a lot of amazing experience and insight in that job. I came back to Colorado and started working more on water policy issues, particularly around the Colorado River and on tribal access to clean drinking water. And I've continued to do that. A couple of years ago, President Biden appointed me to be the U.S. Commissioner on the Upper Colorado River Commission. I got fired in January.
So now I have more time on my hands. No problem. I've always focused primarily on the Colorado River. And so just a month or so ago, a group of folks that I work with, colleagues, scientists, other lawyers, other water wonks, we published a paper about the essential pillars that we believe should be part of the next set of operating guidelines for the Colorado River, which are underway, being negotiated right now. So I'm going to talk about what was in that paper, but I'm first going to sort of set the context. And I know some of you are very familiar with the negotiations that are going on, the current operating guidelines and what's being discussed. So I'm going to do this really briefly, but I want to give some context. So where are we right now? Well, people have been talking about this next set of guidelines for like 4 years. And because this is a heavily federally operated river, the Colorado River, a lot of federal projects, any new set of operating guidelines has to go through an environmental impact analysis. So the National Environmental Policy Act is kind of governing a lot of the timing of what happens with these guidelines. So we're all sitting around waiting for a draft EIS to come from the Bureau of Reclamation. And they've been working on that for a while. They solicited proposals from anybody who wanted to submit one. They did a massive scoping project, but right now they're in the process of analyzing different alternatives. And they will, this is they being the Bureau of Reclamation, they'll provide a draft EIS. And that's going to have modeling of all the alternatives, all the different proposals that they're looking at. We were originally promised that we were going to get that draft EIS last December. It's now promised for this December. There will be, and this is sort of hot off the presses news. This is information that I heard yesterday from the current Acting Assistant Secretary for Water and Science, Scott Cameron, at the Department of the Interior. So he says draft EIS in December and a comment period, so public comment through next March or April, that vicinity. And then there will be a record of decision, has to come before August of next year. Scott said it would be in May or June of next year, which is interesting because the timeline is really tight. It may be that state legislation will be required in order to implement this EIS. And that's particularly true in Arizona, where the state legislature has to approve any new operating system that the state agrees to. It may also be true in Colorado, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. So the final EIS, which we'll hopefully get in, it would have to be May of next year, because there's a 30-day waiting period between a final EIS and a record of decision. That will incorporate all the comments on the draft. So they've set themselves a tight schedule, but it's because we've had a lot of time without a ton of progress to right now. So that's kind of the timing that we're looking at. Can you just advance? Great. Oh, yeah, that's next. Yeah. Okay, so I mentioned that Bureau of Reclamation solicited proposals from anybody who wanted to provide one, and they got a bunch. They got separate proposals from the lower basin states and the upper basin states. There is an environmental NGO coalition that submitted a proposal. There is a sort of consortium of 19 tribes in the basin who came together and suggested not an operating proposal, but principles that should be incorporated into any new operating regime. There was a group of academics, Jack Schmidt, John Fleck, Eric Kuhn, who submitted a proposal, the Gila River Indian Community. There is one from two federal agencies, the Park Service and Fish and Wildlife. And then Reclamation had set up a web tool that anybody could use, and you could do your own proposal, and it would analyze it for you and tell you what the risks were and how well it performed under different circumstances. So they got like 300 or so of those. So they had a lot of stuff to look at. Okay, no, it's working. And in January, Reclamation told us what they were going to analyze in this EIS process. And they published this report and described four action alternatives. They also have a no action alternative, which is required by the National Environmental Policy Act. But they had four action alternatives. Neither the upper basin nor the lower basin alternative that was submitted were adopted in entirety. But they took, Reclamation took pieces from both of those proposals and kind of melded them together in one of these alternatives that they're analyzing that they call the basin hybrid alternative. So three of the alternatives they analyze or are analyzing now would require congressional authority. The other one wouldn't. And the reason they did that is because Reclamation, Interior, I think a lot of folks in the basin are worried that the states, the seven basin states, won't be able to come to a consensus on what an alternative should look like. And Reclamation and Interior will then be required to implement or adopt an operating regime that they can adopt and implement under their own existing authority. So they wouldn't have to seek congressional approval. So that's the first action alternative, what they call federal authorities. So these are existing authorities. No more federal action is required. The other three, one of them is the environmental NGO alternative with some modifications. One of them is a hybrid of the upper basin and the lower basin. And the fourth is a sort of more robust federal proposal that would require congressional action. So they're analyzing those alternatives that they've told us about. And the states have been negotiating for well on 2 years now. Sometimes more intensely than others. There have been some hiatus in the state negotiations, but since the first of this year, the state principals, each appointed by the governor, and of course our principal is Becky Mitchell, they've been meeting at least every 2 weeks, sometimes just the state, sometimes with federal personnel involved, trying to hash out what they can agree on. But they haven't been able to agree. And because of the timing that I just described, it's getting difficult to see that there will be a consensus reached. We hope so. The Department of the Interior really hopes so, because they don't want to have to do this on their own, because they're going to get sued. But it just hasn't happened yet. So that's partly because of the volume of reductions in usage that we need to prepare for. And the problem, of course, overall in the Colorado River is that We're using more water than Mother Nature regularly supplies. On average, the demand is more than the supply, and we've been able to do that because we have big reservoirs. But those reservoirs are being drawn down, and you can't sustain that gap between supply and demand forever. And our flows continue to be volatile, to say the least, and decreased over time because of warming of the climate. So the volume that's required in order to close that gap between supply and demand is really big in some scenarios. On average, it might be around 1.5 million acre feet per year, which is still a lot of water. But we have to plan for more than the average. We have to plan for dry years and for sustained dry periods. And when we look at those scenarios, we're talking more like 2 to 4 million acre feet of gap. And that is really hard. So it has to be allocated among the various states and the various sectors of the economy and between the upper basin and the lower basin. But it's very, very difficult to do because we're talking about existing use that has to be cut back. So it's, I guess that's just a long way of saying the negotiators for the states have really hard jobs. There was a lower basin letter to the Secretary of the Interior in February that didn't help. It basically told the Secretary of the Interior that he should throw out everything that Reclamation had done before and start over and adopt the lower basin alternative. Well, as you can imagine, that didn't go over very well in the upper basin states. And it kind of took things off track for a while. I think we've gotten past that, but stuff like that doesn't help. So we've also seen the freezing or clawing back of federal funding. And that's very hard because one of the things that was helping the states to come to grips with reducing the demand for water was getting compensated for water savings. And that funding, some of it is flowing now, but it's unreliable and it doesn't appear to be prudent to bank on a lot more federal funding. And part of the problem there is we have this reduced supply in the basin. We're using more than Mother Nature provides. We have to get down to back into balance again. And we can't, over the long term, continue to pay people not to use water that doesn't exist. That's the problem. And there's not, you know, even if federal money was flowing and we had all the money available to us from the Inflation Reduction Act, that's going to run out at some point. And long term, it's not sustainable to pay people not to use water that's not there. So the last thing I'll say about a hurdle to the consensus is that, as you all know, as elected officials or working in local government, your job is to represent your constituency and to get the best possible deal for your constituency. And that's what our state negotiators are tasked with doing. That makes it very difficult for them to compromise and to go back to their constituents and say, well, these are hard times. I've had to agree that your water is going to be cut back. That's a hard message to deliver. And so the political pressures are, you know, absolutely valid, but they don't help reach a compromise when it's this difficult. And then we have the hydrology. And I won't spend too much time on this, but the chart shows reservoir levels. The blue line is all the storage in the Colorado River Basin. So that includes the big federal reservoirs, but also Dillon and, you know, other
privately operated reservoirs. The orange line is the one I pay attention to the most, which is Lake Powell and Lake Mead together. And this shows reservoir capacity storage in the reservoirs since 2000 or 1999, I guess, through today. And you can see the downward trend. You don't have to be a climate scientist to see that. We get some upswings when we have good years. We had a good year in 2023, but our trend is downward. So that's just a natural effect of the fact that on average, we use more water than is supplied in the system. So the reservoirs are now at about 33% of capacity. And we're lucky that we have these huge reservoirs in the Colorado River system, and that gives us lots of flexibility, but we don't have that flexibility when the reservoirs are close to empty. And so we need to reverse the trend and hopefully provide for some storage recovery. Oh, I should have said, yeah, inflow to Lake Powell, 45% of average. That's what's projected for this year during the high runoff season. That's dismal. It's like the fourth lowest inflow in the 21st century. So things aren't getting better. And it also shows us that we can't hope for a wet year to solve our problems. So that's the background. That's why a group of us decided that it would be a good time to think about what are the basics? What are the essential principles that we should incorporate into any new set of operating guidelines, whether it's by agreement or imposed by the Department of the Interior? The negotiations haven't seemed to be fruitful yet. And I was at a conference 2 weeks ago where Jim Lockhead, who I'm sure a lot of you know, former CEO of Denver Water and director of natural resources for Colorado, he said, it's like the conclave. These negotiators, we're all sitting there in a room somewhere. We're all waiting for the white smoke, and we haven't seen it yet. So we don't know what's going on in those rooms, but it hasn't resulted yet in an agreement. And we've got new people at Interior and some empty desks. We just yesterday got a nomination for a new commissioner of reclamation, but it will take him a while to be confirmed. We don't have a confirmed assistant secretary for water and science. And frankly, Secretary Burgum doesn't know a whole lot about the Colorado River, and he's got other stuff that he wants to focus on. So again, that's why it seemed like a good time to sort of recall what our basic assumptions should be. So we have seven pillars. I'm just going to talk briefly about each one of them. The first, and these are not in order of priority, and we very consciously decided not to do that. We think they're all important. But this is the one that gets the most attention and is probably the most controversial, particularly in the Upper Basin and in Colorado, frankly. Enforceable reductions in both basins. We think that that's necessary, partly because of the size of that gap between supply and demand that I described. Because it's so large, it doesn't seem that any one basin, any one state, any one sector of the economy can solve that problem by themselves. There's also a question of fairness. Should the lower basin be required to absorb all of the difference between supply and demand, or should there be a spreading out of that burden of reduction? There's also politics, which are going to play a huge role in any operating regime that we see. And what I mean by that is it will be very difficult to get the Arizona legislature to approve, as they will have to do, an agreement that doesn't provide for any reductions in the upper basin. And voluntary reductions are great and can substitute for mandatory reductions, but in order for the lower basin to have some expectation or reliance on what they're going to get, we will need to have some kind of enforceability for whatever the reductions the upper basin absorbs. And I also think, in addition to the politics, the sharing of this burden is necessary to avoid litigation. Because if the upper basin isn't taking any reductions, there's very little reason for the lower basin not to sue. They don't get anything out of an agreement where the upper basin continues business as usual. So that's a hard pill to swallow in the upper basin, and I get that. But from a sort of outsider perspective, we thought this was what was necessary. And we'll have time for questions. We could talk a lot about this. Okay, second, and this is sort of lessons from recent experience, and I talked about this a little bit, we can't found the whole system on compensated reductions from the compensation from the federal government. It's not reliable. We don't know if we'll get more. And it's not a long-term solution. So, and we've seen rescissions. We've seen operational decisions that we can't understand, particularly in California, maybe in the Rio Grande. We're not immune from that. So I think we need to, over the long term, be ready to solve this problem without federal compensation. Now, there may be some federal funding available, and there will be state and local funding. So we're not saying that there's zero compensation available. That's just not the case. But I don't think we can have an operating regime that relies on continued federal compensation. There is one caveat to that, and that is with respect to tribal water rights. You know, we have in Colorado our two tribes, and they give us a perfect example of some of the problems that we need to take into consideration here. Both of those tribes have water rights as part of the Animas La Plata project that they are currently unable to use because they don't have the delivery infrastructure to get the water from Lake Nighthorse or the river to the place of use on the reservation. So they've got decreed rights. You know, we all recognize what the rights are, but they can't use them. And the way they see it, that water, let's say 40,000 acre feet per tribe, flows down the river into the lower basin where farmers get paid not to use it. And the tribes don't get any compensation for that water. And so that doesn't feel right to them. And they were promised this water, but haven't had the internal capacity to develop it. And so all of the states really have acknowledge this problem and want to look into or explore ways of getting the tribes compensation for their unused water. So that's a federal trust responsibility or a treaty responsibility, but that is an exception to this principle of don't rely on federal compensation. Third, conservation pools in Lake Powell and Lake Mead. We already have one in Lake Mead. It's called Intentionally Created Surplus. And that was part of the 2007 guidelines that we're operating under right now. And it was absolutely necessary to prevent the use it or lose it syndrome, where the lower basin states would take all the water they could shove through their pipelines because they didn't want to Well, if they didn't take it, somebody else would get it. And they didn't have any way of storing it and saving it for future use. So conservation pools intentionally created surplus in Lake Mead has been a huge success and absolutely essential to any kind of water conservation program. We can have one in Lake Powell. We could use a conservation pool in Lake Powell to help ensure that the upper basin stays in compliance with the Colorado River Compact by delivering water when the natural flow isn't enough to stay in compliance. And we could also use it, and this has been proposed by the upper basin states, in certain circumstances where the lower basin has to take really huge cutbacks, we could use the pool in Lake Powell to help offset that. So better balance between the basins. And saved water has to have a history of consumptive use, meaning these conservation pools have to be filled with wet water, not paper water. Exception again for the tribes. That's not to say that that undeveloped portion of the water right goes into the conservation pool. That doesn't help the system. We need wet water in those conservation pools, but it doesn't preclude compensation. Fourth, tribal nations need to have full access to the opportunities that other water users have. And that means they need to be able to be advocates for their own water rights, for their own situations. They need to be able to participate in conservation programs, in these conservation pools, just like anybody else. And they need to be able to provide input on all of these proposals. And I'm sure all of you know that that has not always been the case. Even when the 2007 guidelines were put together, tribes were not involved. And as recently as 2019, when the drought contingency plan that we're still operating under was being put together, tribes were not involved. And at that time, there was great outcry from a couple of the tribes in the lower basin in particular, who said, hang on, you are affecting my water rights. I haven't been part of this decision-making process, and we can help. And they did. The Gila River Indian community and the Colorado River Indian tribes have contributed greatly to enabling the reductions required in the lower basin through the drought contingency plan. And that kind of involvement, the tribes want to be part of this process, and they need to be. And we've talked about compensated forbearance. Storage recovery. This is part of what I talked about initially. We have these great assets, these reservoirs that help us deal with a hugely volatile river. You know, our flows can fluctuate like 5 times in a wet year what they were in a dry year. And reservoir storage can mitigate, moderate that volatility. But it doesn't help us when they're almost empty. And they are. 33% full is misleading because that includes all the water in the reservoirs, even the quantity of water that's below Deadpool. So it's really less than 33% capacity that we have now. And that's not sustainable if we want to make use of that flexibility. So we need to come to some sort of formula that tells us how much water everybody can take based on hydrology so that we close that gap. But in times when the reservoirs are low, that formula needs to provide for some component of storage recovery so that we're not always operating in this crisis situation, which is where we've found ourselves for, I would say, the last 10 years. We've been so close, and then everybody scrambles and you know, puts fixes on to help address the slide in the reservoir storage. But as you can see, so far, it hasn't completely solved the problem. One of the things that comes up in talking about storage recovery is that Deadpool situation. So we've got in Lake Powell the ability to get water out of the system until we get down to around 4 or 5 million acre feet in the bottom of the reservoir, and then it just sits there because we don't have the pipes to get it out. Well, we could re-engineer the dam. It would be really expensive, but we could think about it at least. And it's not a long-term solution because that's just one-time water. You know, you evacuate that Deadpool and then it's not there anymore. But it would be useful to compare the cost of that dam construction to put in new outlets, compare that cost to the cost of foregoing the use of 4 million acre feet on a one-time basis, because there's an economic cost there, right? You know, farmers aren't growing crops. Municipalities have to cut back. So that's an economic decision, I think, that we should explore. This one is about that flexibility that we have in the system. You know, it's interesting. We think in the Upper Basin, we think mostly about Lake Powell. Lake Mead is just down the Grand Canyon from Lake Powell. There is virtually zero diversion between Lake Powell and Lake Mead. So you can think of them as one big reservoir, and you can operate them that way, as long as we keep a count of whose water is whose in each of those reservoirs. And because we have that flexibility, we can do good things for the environment without affecting anybody's entitlements or water deliveries. And what I'm talking about is right now, we have annual targets that have to be met in terms of releases from Lake Powell. And those go down to Lake Mead and they stay there until the water is drawn out by lower basin water users. But we don't have to do it that way. We could have more flexibility. We could operate on a 2-year, a 3-year running average. And if things are bad and releases from Lake Powell would do bad things in the Grand Canyon, and I'm using that as an example because it's our iconic national park and is greatly affected by water flows. But it's not the only example. But we could modify releases from Lake Powell to help the environment in the Grand Canyon and then keep a count of how much is owed or how much excess release there was. And, you know, we all know how accounting works. We could make that work. And so one of the things is some of my colleagues on this paper have really been focused on, and it was one of their proposals as an alternative, is that there be annual flexibility. And then last principle, and this may seem just common sense and obvious, but we have to have absolute protection for public health and safety. That mainly means municipal water to get water to people. There may be some industries that we are heavily reliant on that would need to get water, but this has to be our bottom line. We have to protect public health and safety. So those are the seven principles, or seven pillars. We published this paper at the end of April. It's gotten a fair amount of attention, and the reaction has been generally favorable. The majority of the comments that we've received have been favorable. And also, it's like, why'd you have to write this? This is just common sense. Yeah, maybe. We thought it would be a good idea, nevertheless. Some people say, oh, these are just talking heads. They don't know what they're talking about. They don't understand what the hydrology looks like or what the water administration looks like in the Upper Basin. I'd suggest that we do understand that. We may disagree about particularly that first principle about enforceable reductions. But, you know, everybody's got an opinion. And then questions about whether state law changes would be required. And I think the answer to that is yes. And just in Colorado, as an example, if we were to have a conservation pool, as has been proposed in the Upper Basin Alternative, we have to have a way of putting water into that conservation pool. And right now in Colorado, conservation is not considered a beneficial use. So if I've got a ranch and 100 acres that are irrigated, and I want to conserve water on half of those acres, so I only want to use half of my water right, because conservation isn't a beneficial use, I can't even call my full water right to my head gate, and I can't get it down the river. Nobody will shepherd it to the state line. So in order for us to have a viable, implementable conservation pool, we would probably have to have some state law changes, and the state engineer would have to promulgate rules about how it's going to be done. I wanted to just mention that despite the timeline that I laid out at the beginning, there has been more discussion lately about an extension, the possibility of an extension of the existing rules for a year or two. That would require congressional action. But if the states and Interior were supportive, I think that congressional action would occur. There's some problems with that, right? It just kicks the can. We still have to have new operating rules. The existing operating rules are not sufficient to deal with that decline in the reservoir storage, as we've seen. So we need more robust rules regardless. And you know, this year is going to draw those reservoirs down even more. It's not great from that perspective, but that is something that is being discussed. So the reason we did this was to try to lay out the principles necessary for a sustainable system. All of the authors of this paper are independent. We're not answering to particular constituencies. We don't have affiliations with any of the states. And our primary goals were to avoid litigation, which would be a disaster. We want to show that there is fairness throughout this system, recognizing that we're in a difficult situation where we've set our expectations for the use of water that we can't support, that nature is not allowing us to support anymore. And finally, we want to ensure that we have a thriving Colorado River Basin for us and our kids and our grandkids. So that's it. I'm sure people have opinions, and I'd like to hear them. Go ahead.
Thanks for presenting this. I'm on the periphery of this as a, you know, I represent a municipal water operator and manage a, you know, administer a portfolio of water rights. So this is very helpful to me. Of your seven pillars, the one that sort of struck me as maybe being the most difficult to find consensus on is that seventh one that could be construed as prioritizing massive metropolitan areas over rural areas. I'm sure agricultural interests are opposed to that and might argue that food production is as much a health and safety concern as is domestic usage. And so because of that sort of initial reaction I had, I'm curious to hear from you how this group of authors viewed that and maybe sorted out your thoughts on that one.
Good point. And I think we were careful to use the phrase public health and safety and not categorize that as any particular sector. Because you're right. I mean, food production is essential, but you know, to use the crassest example, not growing alfalfa for Saudi Arabia, right? And that's a drop in the bucket. But actually, the Bureau of Reclamation has given some thought to what public health and safety really means, because things were getting so bad in 2021, 2022, that they were worried about being able to release water out of Hoover Dam. So they had to figure out what they were going to do about that. And there's huge agricultural production there, but also cities. So I don't have a complete answer to that, but I think we need to have that conversation about what does it look like if we're in sort of a water knife situation, you know, that novel, apocalyptic, really, really low flows and jeopardy to our ability to get the water out of the dams. Who do we prioritize and how do we do that? So that's a non-answer, but yeah. Yeah.
Hi, can you hear me? Thank you. Thanks for being here. This is great to hear all this. Obviously, it's a very complex issue. I am curious, is Mexico involved in any of this discussion, or is it just mainly just addressing the U.S. concerns regarding the Colorado River?
Yeah, great question. There have been ongoing discussions with Mexico, and in fact, the Lower Basin state's proposal for the reductions in deliveries that they're willing to take assumes an additional contribution from Mexico. Mexico hasn't agreed to that, but Mexico has been an amazing partner in these discussions about Colorado River shrinkage over the years. And we've had several minutes agreements with Mexico that reflect that, where they've agreed to take reductions based on the same levels in Lake Mead that the Lower Basin states do it, and at roughly the same proportion. So I'm hopeful that that's what will occur, but the environmental impact analysis process doesn't include Mexico because federal agencies have no control over that. And so one of the things we said in our paper is Mexico absolutely needs to be a part of this, and they've been great partners, and we can't do it without them, but it's not part of what's being analyzed right now.
Okay. Hey, Anne, thank you so much for speaking and for putting so much thought into this huge issue that we're all dealing with, and for all of the work that you were doing in your position. I'm sorry that you're not in it anymore, and I think that's a real loss for all of us. And I'm buttering you up because I'm about to take a challenging question. And I want everybody to know how much I adore you, and that I would only ask you a challenging question if I knew you could answer it. But on that first principle and the idea of fairness, so to make it a little more simple and easy and lighthearted, thinking of an analogy, let's say PJ and I are your children, and for years, my whole life, you've been giving me a little cookie, and you've been giving PJ a cookie three times the size of mine, and she takes one on the sly every day too, a little cookie. And now we're in a shortage, okay? And we can't make the cookies, you can't make cookies for us the way that you used to. And so we've got to reduce what we're taking, what we're eating. Your fairness example is you're asking me to cut my cookie in half and PJ's cookie in half. And that premise is on asking me to understand that that's fair. Why did you and the authors take that approach on fairness rather than asking PJ to understand that that what's fair is that she starts taking a cookie that's more sizable to what mine is?
Yep, good analogy. Except that we are not at all suggesting that everybody cuts in the same proportion. Not at all. And in fact, there's a line in our paper where we say shared pain, but shared doesn't mean equal in quantity, duration, or triggers. Okay, so I agree with you. That wouldn't be fair because you've been getting the smaller cookie all along. So your contribution to the problem is smaller. And the reductions, to segue, in the upper basin shouldn't be the same in proportion as the lower basin. I don't believe that at all. The problem that what leads me to the conclusion that there needs to be shared pain is partly going back to the Colorado River Compact. And I mean, there are a lot of other reasons, and I alluded to them, but the compact says we can't cause the flow, we in the upper basin can't cause the flow at Lee Ferry to be depleted below 75 million acre feet over 10 years, average of 7.5 million a year. Lots of arguments, lots of lawyers writing papers on what that means, and very vocal disputes about what that phrase means. But it probably means something. It doesn't mean nothing. We also have an obligation to provide half of the obligation to Mexico, which is 1.5 million acre feet unless they're reduced. That doesn't mean nothing either. In order for us, this is my opinion, in order for us to take the position that we don't have to do anything differently than what we're doing now, that hydrology does it for us, we get hit every year by dry watersheds, some years worse than others. All absolutely true. But we've been dealing with that for a century and a half. If we take the position we don't have to do anything more, and we don't care so very much about the 75 million over 10 years because it's not us that's causing the depletion, it's climate change. And we have other arguments about why we don't need to provide half the obligation to Mexico. In order for us to take those positions, we have to read those clauses out of the compact. And personally, I don't think a court would agree with that. So I think we have risk. I think we have risk that we do need to provide 75 million over 10 years and half of the obligation to Mexico, or at least some part of it. And the only way we can get around that is by agreement. If we agree among all the states that we're going to share some burden, but we want relief from those two clauses in the compact, I think that's the only way it works. So you can keep most of your cookie, but not all of it.
Why is it not working?
Thank you.
There we go. So I think Tom and I might agree on many more things than we might imagine. But so I grew up on a family wheat farm in Eastern Oregon, 6,000 acre farm, all dry land, no irrigation, soft white wheat. It's a type of drought tolerant plant that can produce good yields in a low rainfall environment and produce food for people and do it efficiently. You bring up a really good point, though. I had the same question. You know, you mentioned it as that last point being, you know, deliveries for health and safety, and then retracted it in your second statement that that wasn't necessarily municipal, but did directly
municipal.
Okay. But you characterize it when you initially discuss it as primarily municipal. And I definitely see that same logical problem where, you know, food production is critically important. Now, something else you brought up that is probably not known to many people is that there is a Saudi Arabian company, Alamari, and they have a subsidiary company, Bondamonte Farms, that owns land. And in 2018, Saudi Arabia outlawed the production of alfalfa in their own country because of their scarce water resources. Now, we're in a situation where we are, one, allowing foreign countries who may or may not be our adversaries to buy our land, which seems questionable to begin with, and then to produce crops in drought-prone areas because they have high export value. And I guess the reason that's allowed is because, in general, historically, there's strong protections for agricultural water use in states like Arizona and so forth. But are any of those things actually being discussed in a useful and pragmatic way that, hey, certain types of agricultural production are necessary for the sustenance of the nation, essentially, and other uses for national security reasons and other reasons probably shouldn't be allowed and should be outlawed to begin with. I'm just curious what you would have to say about that. I mean, I see that also happening with real estate purchasing in this country on the residential side too. So I'm just not sure why we are so self-defeating. I know we're a free and open society, but I think we do things that are self-defeating a lot of the time.
Yeah. Well, you've raised a lot of really good points and complicated points, right? Governor Hobbs in Arizona has revoked some of the permits that Saudi Arabian companies had for growing alfalfa on public lands, state lands, based on exactly what you're talking about. And I'm not an economist, and I don't have the answers to these very complex questions, but I think we also have to recognize, yes, we're exporting water when we grow alfalfa and ship it to Saudi Arabia. We import a lot of water footprint type stuff, you know, like semiconductors and smartphones and, you know, other things that take water to produce that's not our water, but we're using those products. I don't know how all that balances out. I do know that economics are going to force hard looks at ag production. And certainly ag production for the benefit of foreign countries is going to be at the top of that list. Eric Kuhn, who many of you know, former general manager of the River District, he always says, we don't have a water use problem, we have a grass problem, because we're growing a lot of grass. And it's relatively lower value than other uses that we make of water. That's hard for us to deal with in Colorado, where that grass production, hay meadows, alfalfa, are just part of our way of life. It's part of what we value about our landscape. And those are really hard decisions to make. But there are people who have looked at how much water is going into cattle feed production as a percentage of the overall water use in the basin. Brian Richter has done a lot of work in this area, and it's a lot. It's like well over 50% of the consumptive use for agriculture is for grass and hay. And yeah, we all like to, or most of us like to eat beef and drink milk and eat yogurt and all the things that grass eventually produces. But the value, even when you look at those downstream products, is less than many of the other values that we get from water. So I think the market will deal with at least some of that, but we're going to have to make some hard decisions, I think, in the land use area. And Laura can talk more about this, but, you know, those land use decisions are mostly local, and that local control is very jealously guarded, and for good reason. We want to control our environment, our immediate environment, But that plays into describing who can buy land. You know, we've had that discussion in Colorado about hedge funds, and it doesn't go well because we don't like the idea of having hedge funds coming in and buying up our ag land for the water rights. On the other hand, farmers don't like being told who they can sell to. So we've got to strike a balance, and it's like a lot of these questions, really complex.
We have Tori on the Zoom who has a question, so we'll let her go before we do another question in the room.
Awesome. Okay. Hi. Thanks, everybody. Thanks so much, Anne, for being with us. I'm sorry, I'm not there. So I think you've hinted at some of this. You've kind of integrated it in as you answered some of the questions. But what I was hoping you could share with us or talk about a little bit more is how you envision those kind of reductions working in the upper basin where, I mean, in particular, I'm just thinking if there's no snow melt, how would the upper basin reduce without having those huge reservoirs to stockpile? Could you talk a little bit about how that would work for, I guess, us in the upper basin?
Yeah. So what we're talking about is curtailment. And that's a word that people really don't like to hear or use. But if we're only able to use a certain quantity of water, and there's more water available in the streams, then we have to have some way of administering that. That's what they do in the Rio Grande. The Rio Grande Compact requires a certain amount of delivery at the state line to New Mexico, and the state engineer tries to figure out and does a pretty good job of it how much water use can occur upstream in the state line in order to ensure that the right amount of water passes over. And they do it in the priority system. He shuts down water rights in reverse order of priority. So we know how to do this. In the Colorado, in the West Slope, in the Colorado River Basin, it's more complicated because we have different basins. You know, we have the Gunnison and the San Juan and the Colorado Mainstem and the Yampa White. And all of those basins got adjudicated at different times. They have different administration in priority. So we'd have to figure out whether we're going to do it on a statewide basis, whether we're going to do it basin by basin. If we do it basin by basin, how does it get divided up? People have thought about this kind of stuff. So prior appropriation is one way to do this. It's also been suggested that we could have pro rata reductions. That gets a lot of pushback. And understandably, people have senior water rights that they have husbanded for generations, taken care of, protected, fought over, and they don't want to be told to reduce when juniors are still getting the same amount of water. So it's kind of like the cookie problem. I personally think that we're used to prior appropriation. You know how that works. That's the most likely scenario, but this would be something that the state engineer would figure out in a rulemaking process. State engineer has the authority to administer for compact compliance, and that would be part of the deal. So did that answer your question, Tori?
Yes, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Somebody over here. Yeah.
Okay, I think I got it. Hi, I'm a county commissioner in Gunnison County. And so, Laura, this has been super interesting. I just want to say thanks to start with. I am not a water professional. I am a generalist. I make decisions about lots of things. And so I appreciate you going back and doing some of the background and also giving enough substantive detail that I feel like I'm really walking away with a clear idea of what some of the sticking points are. So thanks for that. There's a lot that you've talked about that I'm like, I have thoughts. Let's talk about local control. But my question really is, knowing that these are multi-state negotiations and that they are happening in this conclave and that it is highly political and very tense and hasn't made a lot of headway. You said something about how there some of these principles, if enacted in the in whatever the negotiations turn into, could require some state law changes. Some you just talked about rulemaking, and I'm wondering if there are things we can do at a state level to try to prepare for the future and not necessarily giving in, because I liked April's question a lot. I had the same question. How is that fair? So not necessarily like giving up things we're not ready to give up, but like, are there practices or programs? I think about shepherding water, measuring water, conservation programs, not compensation necessarily, but are there things we could be doing at a state level so that we have better systems in place for whatever is coming down the pipeline?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think there are things we could do. I mean, I think we're all in favor of water conservation, but we can't do it with an agricultural water right now because water conservation is not considered a beneficial use, and we can't shepherd the savings to where we want it to go, whether that's our own downstream reservoir or Lake Powell. So the legislature could solve that problem. I will tell you that if Becky Mitchell were here, or Lauren Riss, director of the CWCB, they would say, yes, but not now, because they believe that taking action, taking legislative action along those lines would undermine Becky's negotiating position. I think we need to consider, because as an upper basin state, we've proposed a conservation pool. In my opinion, we would have a stronger negotiating position if we could back that up. And right now we can't, not in Colorado. Utah can. Utah has enacted legislation recently that allows them to conserve, treats that as a beneficial use, and allows the state engineer to shepherd it to where it's supposed to go. So it can be done. I don't, I'm not in the room, but I don't think that's undermined Utah's negotiating position. And I think it sends the message that we're ready to back up the proposals that we've made.
All right. Any more questions? All right. We got one more.
Hi there. And thank you again. I guess I was wondering about evaporative loss in Lake Mead and Lake Powell, and just the concept that I think in hindsight, had we known more when those dams were built, that from an evaporative loss standpoint, it seems better to have reservoirs in higher elevations, and how much. And, you know, I think that the solution to this problem is going to have to be multifaceted. And if that might not be part of the solution, is to focus on water storage more in higher elevations where we have a lot less evaporative loss.
Yeah. The sort of Phil Powell first concept. Yeah. So there's been a focus on evaporative loss for a really long time. And, you know, there's the famous case of Arizona versus California that the U.S. Supreme Court decided in 1963. That case was originally brought in 1952, back in the day. And one of the questions that they wanted the Supreme Court to answer was, who bears the evaporative loss in Lake Mead? Supreme Court never got to that. And in fact, when Arizona brought that lawsuit, they asked three different questions, none of which got answered in the Supreme Court, which is one of the downsides of litigation. So the lower basin has recognized for a while, past 5 years or so, that they're getting all the water that they think they're entitled to from Lake Mead, but not accounting for the evaporative loss. So that's one of the reasons the reservoirs are declining. We in the upper basin, we already bear our evaporative loss because what gets into Lake Powell has already borne those evaporative losses on the way down. Different situation in the lower basin. And the evaporation from the surface of Lake Mead is estimated to be somewhere between 1.2 and 1.5 million acre feet per year. It's a lot of water. The lower basin recognizes that that's their problem, and they have proposed to own that deficit. And so all of the proposals say that the lower basin will bear the first 1.5 million acre feet of reductions. Some of that they want Mexico to bear, but same idea. It does have to be part of the calculation. In terms of where we put the water, there's we need to do more scientific study on that, because one of the things I found out when, you know, thinking about the same issue is there's a lot of seepage from Lake Powell. Just the type of geological formation that Lake Powell sits in leaks. And so and the higher it is, the more seepage occurs. So there's some offsets there. And I don't know how that factors into the overall equation. But if we could save water, if we could save 300,000 acre feet a year by putting the water all in one lake or the other, then we ought to be looking into that and doing it, because we can keep all the same benefits by paper accounting for that water. And if we can save water by doing it, then we should. That might be a good place to end.
Well, everyone, let's thank Anne so much for giving of her time, her work, her efforts. Thank you so much. It's greatly appreciated. So next up on the agenda, we have Laura from Western WRA, who's going to be talking about some implementation about SB 24005.
Great.
So thank you.
How are we doing for time?
Are we good? We are running right on time. We're a couple minutes past, but we should be able to get everything in.
Yeah, and Laura, if you don't mind if I jump in real quick before you get started. First of all, I think some of the consultant team, we're pretty good at shaving off our time so that you don't have to. So anyway, I think Ashley and I can shave off some of our updates, so don't worry too much about that, at least from my perspective. And then I just wanted to let QQ members know, some of you probably weren't around when the Senate Bill 5 was adopted. I can't believe that was just last year. But I just wanted to let you all know that, you know, not only are there, is Laura's talking to you all today, I guess, about implementing this new legislation. I'm sure she'll tell you a little bit about what this legislation says and does. But I wanted to let you all know that back when this was proposed, QQ did support this bill that ended up passing and may have been the only or one of the only local government groups that did support the state giving some sort of direction to local governments about regulating or, you know, to what degree local governments could regulate functional and non-functional turf, basically instructing local governments that they could not allow non-functional turf in the future. And so, and part of the rationale for you all supporting this bill, and I just wanted you all to kind of understand some of QQ's interest in this from the beginning, is really you have policies that direct that QQ work to support efforts that use Trans Mountain diversion water responsibly, efficiently, really using Trans Mountain diversion water to extinction, using it as much and as many times as possible and as efficiently as possible. And because so much of the Front Range is really the focus of, you know, eliminating this non-functional turf,
I think that's a big part of why you all supported this bill. And so, you know, now we're turning to all local governments implementing this bill, but I just wanted to make sure that you all knew that from the beginning, at least, you know, what the consultant team understood from your interest in this bill is that it is a way to direct usage on the front range to use Trans Mountain Diversion Water responsibly. And as a result, you know, everyone, you know, we're also helping you all learn how to implement, or, you know, helping you all implement this in your own local governments too. So, and definitely Western Resource Advocates is leading the charge in doing that implementation work. So, thanks, Laura, for helping us get started on that, this next phase.
Yeah. And thanks, Tori. That's great background and really appreciate it. And thank you all for the invitation. I'm happy to be here chatting with you. How many of you are familiar with Senate Bill 5? Okay, pretty good. Yeah, and so I'm Laura Belanger with Western Resource Advocates. We worked on this bill, and we've been working with the Brendel Group on a project to help local governments with implementation of the bill. So what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about Senate Bill 5 first, just the basics of it, then also touch on House Bill 251113, which the governor recently signed, which both adds to Senate Bill 5 as well as makes a modification. But the most focus will be on Senate Bill 5, and then talk about materials that we've been developing to really help local governments as they work to update their codes to come into compliance. And then also think about, like, okay, now that our code's been updated, how do we implement this? How do we review plans? What's enforcement look like? That sort of thing. And so can we by any chance move that? And sorry, I'm borrowing someone else's slides. They're a little more wordy than I would typically do. But the basics of Senate Bill 5, again, it was passed last year. It was really, as Tori said, to conserve our water resources. I think a lot of us, probably every one of us, has seen turf being irrigated somewhere where you're like, why is that grass and why are they irrigating and why is half it running down the road? So it really looks at large properties, non-residential properties, commercial, institutional, industrial, medians, transportation corridors, places where you really don't need turf. And so we call that them non-functional areas. So areas where it just doesn't need to be grass. You're not walking on it. The only person who generally touches it is the person that's maintaining it. So Senate Bill 5 limits that, and it's in new development only. So that's important. I think there's been a lot of confusion about the bill. It's only new development, and it also triggers when a redevelopment project disturbs more than 50% of the landscape area. So if there is a big redevelopment project, it can kick in. And then another thing that the bill drafters intended, but it was not clear in the bill, is that say it is a big redevelopment project and you are disturbing more than 50% of the landscape area, it only affects the portion of the landscape that's being disturbed. So there's no like turf tear out. It's only when something's already going to be replaced. And then the key point is, and it's coming up quickly, that the implementation date of the bill is next January. So that's when codes have, they're supposed to be updated by next January. And so if folks haven't started working on it yet, like that can be a pretty tight timeline given internal processes to update code. And another thing that wasn't clear in the bill that I'll just let you all know about is it says like local governing entities shall not allow non-functional turf to be installed by this date. But again, the intention was really just that code should be adopted by this date. And so any projects or plans that have been approved prior to this date, like those may install non-functional turf, and that is fine. And that is in compliance with Senate Bill 5. And we're trying to clarify that in some of our materials that we've been developing. And then just to quickly touch, how about House Bill 1113? Familiarity with that? Okay. That the governor just signed. Our project that I'll talk about in a minute, and it's funded by the CWCB, it really is focused on Senate Bill 5. So the materials I'm going to talk about really are focused on that only. We had to put those boundaries on, except Senate Bill 5 did change that. House Bill 13 changed. Senate Bill 5 prohibited artificial turf, across the board, that just no more artificial turf anywhere on those non-residential properties. House Bill 1113 changed that. It defined non-functional artificial turf and functional artificial turf. So like, you know, athletic fields, places where people are recreating, where you might want to put artificial turf in, that's now allowed because that's functional, a functional area. And that has the same due date as the Senate Bill 5 due date. So we are like updating our materials to reflect that. But just something to be aware of, and with a later due date of 2 years later, January 1st, 2028, House Bill 1113, it does add multifamily residences with 12 or more units to the applicable properties covered by Senate Bill 5. So like all the requirements in Senate Bill 5 in 2028 will also apply to multifamily dwellings of more than 12 units. And then it does touch residential. It says that local governing entities shall regulate turf. It doesn't say limit. It says regulate turf by that January 1st, 2028 date. And that's all it says, because there's obviously a lot of, you know, residential gets a lot more tricky. There is a lot more, people feel very strong about their residential properties. So it leaves it completely up to the local governing entity to figure out what that will look like, you know, in your community. But it does say that you do need to have some sort of regulations on turf and residential properties. So that's a big one. And there are a lot of different ways to regulate turf on residential properties. You can do water budgets. You can say no back, you know, front yard turf. You can say certain percentages of the landscape area can only be turf. So that's going to be a little more complicated for folks to think about. But our current materials don't address that yet. I think I said all this. Just two things to stress are that, you know, again, Senate Bill 5 doesn't require turf removal, and right now it doesn't apply to residential properties. So Senate Bill 5, it does prohibit non-functional turf in these non-residential properties. It also prohibits invasive plant species, and those are synonymous with noxious weeds. And in hindsight, probably should have used that terminology. Noxious weeds are already regulated under the Colorado Noxious Weed Act, and that's managed at the county level. And so our guidance materials just point folks towards that. So really, noxious plants are already regulated. And then it prohibits non-functional turf and non-functional artificial turf. And we applied the non-functional terms to the turf and the functional terms to the turf. But I just think of it like the area, like think about the usage. Like if no one's using the area, if it's not being used for actively recreating, people don't go sit outside on something for lunch, you know, that's really where you can think about the definition. But locally, you are going to have to kind of figure that out. You know, how do you say this is a non-functional area? This would be non-functional turf. But where it's a place where you could use lower water use grasses, water-wise landscaping, and it just would not affect the area usage at all. And so then when you think about functional areas, and that is defined here, it's turf that's located in a recreational use area or other areas that use regularly for civic, community, or recreational purposes. And then there's a list of potential places that your community may choose to call functional areas. The one thing I just wanted to flag here is, and we were very particular to do this, where it says portions of parks, and we hope that people will really be very cautious around parks and don't just blanket say like parks are functional, because what we've found from our work with communities is that parks offer some of the best opportunities. Like there is a lot of area, there's a lot of acreage in parks, and oftentimes there's a lot of area that's really not used. It's on the edge. It's an opportunity where you don't need to put turf in, you know, retention basins, things like that. So as folks do update their codes or create codes to be compliant with Senate Bill 5, they just think a lot about parks and that there's a lot of opportunity there to put in these lower water use grasses or water-wise plants instead of turf. And then if it is a functional and actively used area, then you can put anything there. You know, you can put anything you want there. And then also, you know, if a grass, sod, or seed is native or has been hybridized for arid conditions, so it's lower water use, you can put that anywhere you want. And then same thing with Waterwise Landscaping. That can go anywhere you want. And so I think I'll stop there just for a second because I was going to switch gears to our project. But does anyone have any questions about the bills or anything I can clarify before I hop? Yes.
My read of this, and I just want to verify, is that this really applies to irrigated grasses. That if we have non-irrigated grasses in parks or rights of way, those are okay. That's not covered. Right. And one question, tell me if this isn't the right time for this one, but in my community, in the environment that we're in, we find that we oftentimes have to temporarily irrigate areas for one or two summers to get those to establish, and then we can end that. And I'm not clear, and I'll use the example of like a rights of way. I'm not clear how this applies to that, what we view as temporary irrigation activity, which is for us typically two seasons. Yeah.
Thank you. Great questions. So yeah, the question is like when you need to temporarily irrigate grass, like how does Senate Bill 5 or does Senate Bill 5 come into play? And I would say no. I mean, establishment is completely different. And in the instances you mentioned, once the grasses are established, they either require no water or they require little water. And so that's what we're talking about. Grasses like post-establishment, it's all about like how much water do they need. So if you put Kentucky bluegrass on a median, you would have to continue to irrigate that if you don't want it to just brown up. So that would not be allowed. But any other grass that then can, you know, be healthy and survive, then that's completely allowed. Okay, so our project is really to help communities with Senate Bill 5 implementation. We're working with the Brendel Group, and this is funded by a CWCB Water Plan grant. We have a technical advisory committee, and we just had our third meeting yesterday. And we started off by doing a community survey around the state, and we were really happy. We got 63 unique responses or responses from 63 unique communities, and we got really good geographic distribution around the state, which is wonderful. And then that really helped us, that survey, as well as input from our technical advisory committee, figure out, well, what are some priority materials that we can develop to help communities as they think about implementing Senate Bill 5. And so we've been doing that, and those priority resources were actually, they're all written up. They're currently being designed and they'll be available at the end of the month. So I share a link later where you can access them. And now we're doing a lot to just get out there, push the materials out. So thank you very much for this opportunity. This is great. And what we heard was from the survey and from our technical advisory committee is Senate Bill 5 is a little confusing, probably like a lot of legislation. It definitely confused people. And then also it referred to a lot of definitions that were elsewhere in statute, like even turf, like you had to go to a completely different statute to look up like how is turf defined. So we heard a lot like pulling all that together in a fact sheet, you know, really high level summary of the bill with key information would be very helpful. Same thing, that definitions library, let's pull them all into one place. What are some examples of compliant code? That would be really helpful if we could look at that and think about that as we're updating our code. And then once code is updated, okay, so now how do we review these landscape plans and enforce it? I mean, a lot of communities are small. They don't have folks on staff that are familiar with different grasses and landscape materials. So how do we do this? And then, yeah, what might enforcement look like? Resources for what landscape material is and isn't allowed. I mean, the bill has definitions, but it's not crystal clear. It's still confusing. And then help materials to help us communicate with developers. What are our regulations now? What do they need to do to comply? So the resources that we are going to have available by the end of the month, there is a fact sheet right now on our website. I don't know if that went out or not, but it's going to be updated because we needed to add that change for artificial turf. We've got what we call the key considerations guide. And that's really the big overarching document. It's a discussion document for communities, and I'll provide a little more detail on that, but it's just to help you really walk through the process. This compliant code matrix, it's in Excel. It pulls in like different terminologies and different way communities are addressing it so that you can look at different opportunities. Some of it goes above and beyond Senate Bill 5. It's currently limited just because the bill implementation date's not till January, but we're going to keep keeping it updated, but that's a good resource. And then we pulled together a grasses and plants guide to help people think about like what's prohibited and what's allowed in those non-functional spaces. And we're currently evaluating additional resource needs. And we had our meeting yesterday, and I think we're going to be focusing most of our efforts on resources for smaller communities that have really limited resources, maybe like a kind of bare bones, like what's the minimum you need to do to come into compliance, potentially just some template code you could just adopt that could work. So we're going to start working on that now. So here's the fact sheet. This is the old version. Like I said, it's being updated right now, but it includes, key information, the timeline, applicability, prohibitions, key definitions. And then we added an FAQ section that really addresses a lot of the questions and concerns we've been hearing. The key considerations guide, again, this is the guide that everything else is nestled underneath. It consolidates the key terms, talks about special considerations. Like, for example, if you're updating your code, like think about putting a lot of things in more administrative documents. Like you could have a landscape guidance document outside of code that the code points to, because that's going to be a lot easier to update and provide a lot more flexibility versus if you put all the details in your code, things like that. It clarifies the bill intent, the things I just talked about regarding implementation date and redevelopment landscape. Another thing we heard, there's already a ton of materials out there, so don't recreate the wheel. So we very much rely on existing things and point people to them. In these materials, we have links, so we tried to do that. And then we have templates for communicating with developers about your code and what they need to do to comply. And this is what we call key considerations at a glance. And then the document like follows through all this. So yeah, it talks about timelines and impacts. How do you get your code updated? And then how do you identify when SB 5 kicks in? Like what's an applicable development? So thinking about that. And then once your code is adopted, yeah, what's your review process? How are you going to handle when new plans come in, like whether they're in compliant or not, and what information do they need to provide to you? And then also inspections and enforcement, like how are you going to do that? So it provides a lot of options. So it doesn't just like say, we thought we were going to do a checklist or a flowchart when we started working on this document, and then we realized that wasn't going to work. It wasn't going to be helpful. We really just needed to provide like really a lot of options for communities to look at and think about. And then the compliant code matrix, really, it just pulls in different terminologies and how different communities write them, how people identify applicable properties, how people have turf limits, and like address the no invasive plant species. And I just put this up because, again, Senate Bill 5, you don't need to be compliant right now. But the city of Edgewater recently updated their code to be compliant. And then Aurora also has long had very good code that has real strict turf limits. So these actually go above and beyond Senate Bill 5. You'll see there are residential limits here. Aurora doesn't allow turf on golf courses versus Senate Bill 5 does allow it. But Edgewater, for example, like one of the way they start defining like non-functional areas is areas that are less than 8 feet wide or on slopes greater than 25%. Those are areas people are likely not recreating. So these are just some examples of existing code that would be compliant. And then the grasses and plants guide, it is high level. We had really thought a lot about like balancing level of detail for that. And we also, I just want to again iterate that it is focused on Senate Bill 5. So it's focused on non-residential properties. I think when we start thinking about residential properties, it gets more, it's going to get more confusing, more detailed. We're going to have to really think about that a lot. So here it's pretty, really easy by focusing on what grasses are allowed and not allowed in functional and non-functional areas. So the Colorado Native Grass Guide, I don't know if anyone's familiar with that, but that's a project that a lot of experts from around the state recently developed. It's an online resource. We relied really heavily on that. And so all the grasses in that guide, for example, you could put in non-functional areas. And then we provide some guidance on how you might want to also incorporate other grasses, like the bill says, that are hybridized for arid conditions. Like, how exactly might you define that in your code? And then we do a lot of links to existing resources on waterwise plants. A lot of communities have prohibited or allowable plant lists that you can look at. And then we point folks to that Noxious Weed Act and where to find resources on that, as well as some implementation considerations to think about. So these resources, will this PowerPoint be made available? Yeah, so this QR code will take you to those. Again, they're not up now, but they'll be up by the end of the month. WRA also has a landscape transformation hub where we have these and a lot of other resources. So you can access these. And then I wanted to just share a few other resources as well. We have this guide to developing water conservation-oriented tap fees. That's also being updated, but this current guide's super helpful. That's another way that you can incentivize more water efficient landscaping. And then the Sonoran Institute, communities who've wanted like more one-on-one assistance as they're thinking about this, they have a technical assistance program you can apply through Growing Water Smart and Water Now Alliance. They have a project accelerator program as well that you can apply to for assistance. And then the Department of Local Affairs, DOLA, has a template land development code that goes way beyond Senate Bill 5, but there's a landscape component of that that is SB 5 compliant. So that's a resource to take a look at. And that is in our compliant code matrix. We've pulled that in. And then South Metro Water Supply Authority, they have a really good regional model landscaping and irrigation ordinance. And then these are good community codes, Broomfield, Aurora, Castle Rock, and Edgewater, that are either compliant, close to compliant, or even beyond Senate Bill, that goes beyond Senate Bill 5. So with that, if anyone has questions, but I actually want to start with a question to you all first, because I mentioned our next step is to really focus on low communities with limited resources and maybe limited expertise. So we're looking to interview communities that are in the progress of updating their code to be SB 5 compliance. So we can kind of understand like what's your process, what have you been running into, maybe how you address some hurdles. Is anyone here in the midst of updating code for Senate Bill 5? And if so, might you be open to us interviewing you?
Hey, Laura, this is Julie Baxter online. The Steamboat is in the middle of updating our code, and I'd be happy to talk with you.
Okay, sorry, who was that?
Julie Baxter. I'm with the City of Steamboat Springs.
Awesome, thank you.
Yep.
Hey, Julie, while you're talking, could I plug you to share one of the challenges that you guys have already kind of run into about the concept of redevelopment? But if you're only redeveloping a landscape, I think you'll be able to explain it better. But
yeah, well, I saw a little bit in the definition of redevelopment that was just in the PowerPoint, but like we don't have any sort of landscaping like any separate landscaping permit outside of a building permit or development permit process. And so, I mean, somebody could, a commercial development could just redo their whole landscape. Like they could just put in turf everywhere and we would never like see it if it wasn't part of a larger like development permit. So that was one thing. And the other thing that we have run into, which it sounds like these resources might address, is like the hybridized grasses are allowable. And like all the grass seed that's pretty much used in town is a hybrid that's been hybridized for arid conditions. But like, what's the percentage of blue, you know, there could be like percentages of Kentucky bluegrass in there with like other types of grasses and native grasses. So we were like, well, this doesn't do anything unless we have some sort of definition of what counts as a hybridized for arid conditions grass seed. So those are just a couple. And then we just have, you know, just the planning department, like just figuring out how they're actually going to like inspect and administer some of this is going to be tough capacity wise.
Great. Thank you, Julie. And yeah, and I should have mentioned that. I think it was on the slide, but I didn't talk about it. But yeah, the hybridized, that's confusing because as Julie said, pretty much every grass on the market right now, unless it's a native grass, is hybridized grass. And so, and even grasses that say drought resistant or heat resistant, I did this in my yard. That just means they'll come back. So you can water them less in like a drought, say, for example, and they're going to go nice and brown, but they're not dead. So then when I water them again, back to like what they really need, they'll come back. And so that's not what we want, right? We don't want grasses that really need more water and we're just letting them be brown. So we try to talk about that a little bit. Like you really need to try to get, I think what we did was we looked at the native grasses and the native grass guide. They use between 60 and 60% less. They have between 60 and 60% less. Well, some of them have zero irrigation needs, but we've stuck with that than Kentucky bluegrass. And so we suggest one thing communities might want to do is look at like in your area, in your region, what does Kentucky bluegrass need for supplemental irrigation? And then like pick a percentage less than that, that the grass requires annually. And you may need to talk to the manufacturer about that. And you kind of set that threshold and say grasses that use, you know, have irrigation needs, supplemental irrigation needs below that threshold, like those you can put in non-functional areas, and anything that needs more than that, like you can't put in non-functional areas. Cause again, the whole point is to save water. So yeah, but it's super confusing. And so we're trying to help with that, but there's not a very clear answer on that. Sorry, do you have a question?
Is this, yes. So aside from my role at Eagle County Government, I'm vice president of my HOA. Very fun. But we are trying to update our declarations and our design guidelines that require every house to have turf, 3 trees, and 5 shrubs in the front yard. And because it's, you know, we have to get consensus on what the language should be like. We want it to be well informed and we have resources for that in the community. But then we have to engage a certain threshold of HOA members to vote on it, which is like 150. And then recognizing that the town of Eagle is going to have to adopt some codes around this by January of 2028. How do we write it in a way that doesn't create any conflict, which is what we have now, where there's town codes that are kind of in conflict with some of our documents. So I don't know if you're interested in speaking with HOAs at all about our role in turf and water conservation, but happy to.
Great. Thank you. I will actually get your contact info. Yeah. And I did want to just flag, and I don't know if this would be helpful to you or not, but so this is all new development, right? This is stuff going in, but we also worked a lot on there. I don't remember the number of the bill, but back in 2023, the state funded for 2 years turf replacement funding in the state. So that was to remove turf. And we also did a big project that we called Enabling. It was a really long project name. I've learned not to do that. Enabling the replacement, the large scale replacement of non-essential turf. So it was about like big plots of non-functional turf, like how to get that out. And HOAs, as I'm sure many folks in here were identified as one of the most challenging, you know, for a lot of the reasons you just identified. So we actually have a whole document we created that was case studies at HOAs, how to talk to your HOA, how to make the economic case to HOA. And that's pulling it out. But yes, absolutely. HOAs are really key, and they can be very complicated. And yeah, I mean, who's on the board? What do they think? And they're definitely one of the most challenging. Thank you.
The other thing that may be worth mentioning for HOAs, and again, no idea the bill number or the year at this point, but HOAs are, I mean, hopefully everybody in this room knows, but HOAs are not allowed to prohibit, they're not allowed to require basically turf. Like HOAs have to allow landscaping that is other than turf, just to throw that out there too. Hopefully everybody knows that, but that was maybe just 5 years ago, something like that.
Yeah. Thanks, Tori. And I should have thought of that, which unfortunately, as you know, like a lot of HOAs they're not even aware of that bill. There's really very little enforcement of that. But yeah, basically, you know, it's not legal to have those requirements that you have so much turf on your property, but a lot of HOAs still do have that in their bylaws.
I'll just make another point, Tom Boyd from Eagle County. We did the groundbreaking for our demonstration garden at the Eagle County building this week. And while oftentimes as local governments, we are there to say what the rules are, don't break these, we also find, I think that it's helpful to say, here's what success looks like. And we're going to try and go through this at our building so that you can kind of learn from what we're going through. And then it not only becomes a really nice piece of land, but it kind of becomes a case study. Folks can come by, other HOA folks can come by, people in the community can come by and talk to, you know, our CSU extension office and folks in our county about what does it look like? What do the alternatives look like? Because to me, what's really behind this law is a change of mentality that throughout the state that we need to recognize the aridity of the place that we live. And yet we are a state that is full of many, many, many transplants. And a lot of folks have come here from places that have a lot more water and a lot more turf. And even those of us who grew up here, maybe just kind of have a mentality that needs to be reset to say, hey, there's a lot more that we can do that isn't bluegrass and still great. And yet at the same time, we recognize there are places for that bluegrass and for turf and for soccer and all that good stuff. So. That's what I think is really behind it. And I think if as leaders, we can demonstrate that publicly, that'll help make the adoption of these codes and these laws go more smoothly.
Great. Thank you. That's great to know too. And that's important too, because a lot of this high elevation is very different, right? I mean, I think we are going to, like the whole landscape industry doesn't know how to do this new landscaping that they're going to be forced to start doing next year. And so that's a big issue. So understanding like how grasses are growing and like how much irrigation do they need, what's the maintenance on them, and having that locally available, as you said, as a resource for people to lay eyes on, but also just to figure out like exactly how does this work at these high elevations and in this community. So that's really going to be critical. And I would point folks to that turf replacement funding bucket went away, but the water plan, the CWCB water plan grants, those actually have a lot of funding available for land use and water conservation. And so there are opportunities there for communities if you did want to like develop a demonstration garden or do a pilot turf replacement program and then basically replace it with a demonstration garden. The CWCB has recently funded several of those projects. So there is, like, if any other communities were interested in doing that, that would be a good potential funding source for that. Any other questions?
Sure. I have a question about kind of the enforcement side of this. I think for our community, very small community, we've got, I don't know, a backlog of code enforcement work that's probably a decade long already. And as was mentioned by someone else, we have no permitting process for landscape reinstall projects, right? And so, you know, we can see a homeowner or a business owner come in and you know, initially at development, install great water saving landscape, and then decide they want to redo that for aesthetic reasons, right? And so I think that's going to be a big challenge for us. But what I don't understand is how the state is going to enforce upon local communities that we comply, both with code adoption and then this ongoing enforcement effort. And I'm curious to learn what you might know about that.
Good question. And I don't have a perfect answer. We definitely have had people say there's no enforcement in Senate Bill 5, right? It just says thou shalt. But the fact that the statute's out there and it says you shall do this, you know, it potentially could be enforced, but there are, yeah, at this point, there's nothing defined for enforcement. You know, like some things, the CWCB, if you want to apply for a grant, you know, you have to have a water efficiency plan in place if you have, you know, supply more than a certain amount of water. But right now, there isn't that enforcement portion of it. I think what we've said is if you're not compliant, there is the potential that someone could sue, you know, but other than that, I don't know that the state has anything planned for enforcement. I think we're really hoping that this is, as you know, you said, that we're going to start just shifting our norms and shifting what landscape looks like and shifting the expectations. And the goal of this is really to like accelerate that and make it happen sooner. And this ties into like what Anne was talking about, right? And we really do need to change how we're using water, both in the agricultural sector at times, as well as in the municipal sector. But yeah, I think a lot of it's really going to be voluntary compliance, but we'll see. I mean, I'm not the state, obviously.
I'll just chime in and say, I mean, I just totally agree with Laura. There isn't anything in the bill, and that's what I've always imagined how this plays out also is, you may find that you're looking for a grant for something from the CWCB, or also DOLA's pretty savvy to this too. So some of your DOLA grants, you could run into them saying, are you making any progress here? And I could imagine if they're doing that, it's not going to be a hard and fast January 1st, 2026. It's also going to be like, are you taking steps? Like, what are you doing? It's not, I doubt that they'll even be so hard as to say no grants unless you absolutely have a regulation on the book. So.
Yep. Cool. Did you have a?
There you go. Sorry. Callie Rand with Eagle County. And as Commissioner Boyd had mentioned, we are in the middle of our land use reg update. There has been some conversation about limiting turf and concerns with if that turf is being watered with agricultural water rights and bumping into the use it or lose it if you were to limit that in developments or residentially. Is there been any conversation or information on that?
No. And I would say, again, I point to that this is all new development. And so this would be new water use, potentially. I mean, if you're using water you conserved by being efficient elsewhere and applying it. But no, that is not something we have thought about. That. But I don't have an answer, but I will think about that. But I mean, I would assume it's the same as any other, right? Like applying it to ag use, you just have to be careful about that. I mean, I would hate to see people start saying like, no, we need to keep irrigating our turf because of use or lose it. That would not be ideal, you know? But yeah, it's the same thing as with, you know, if you're applying it to for pasture or for, you know, to grow hay for, to be harvested. I mean, then you just run into the same issues of like the use it or lose it.
Yeah, and a lot of our developments are agricultural lands that are purchased and then developed with those rights. So in our community.
I mean, I think, you know, maybe Ann can step in or someone else who's an attorney. Municipal water, so there's still ag rights because they're being applied outside. They're not domestic use. Because, you know, there's the like growing, great and growing cities doc, like municipal water rights are a little bit, I think, more flexible potentially, as long as like you're going to have additional demands projections in the future, you can have water rights that like are exceeding your current needs. So I don't know like if that could come into play or not, but again, I'm definitely stepping a little bit outside my comfort level with that one. There you go.
I mean, something that might be similar is in the town of Gypsum, you could very well have a metro district come in with a development plan that is, yeah, historically agricultural water rights. And I do think that that situation could crop up.
All right. Well, thank you for broaching that. And that's actually really, I mean, that's one of the reasons we're here too, is not just to share our resources, but understand these type of issues so we can think about that moving forward, both with this existing legislation as well as anything else moving forward regarding municipal efficiency and like potential impacts and unintended impacts. So thank you for broaching that.
All right. Well, I think, let's thank Laura. Thank you so much for all that information. We're going to do a quick abbreviation or change to the schedule. So Ashley and Tori will be combining their consultant updates. So right now, lunch is available. We are going to have a condensed lunch because we have so many other things we want to get in. So we're going to be starting. We'll be meeting back at 12:40. Feel free to head outside, grab yourself a lunch, wash your hands, and we'll see you guys back, and feel free to visit, and we'll see you guys back in about 35, 40 minutes. All right. It looks like we are back. Thank you. Hope you guys enjoyed the sun or enjoyed each other while you were having your lunch today. Next up on our agenda, we have Esther Vincent from Northern Water, and she's going to give us a quick update on what's going on with Chimney Hollow and the uranium. So Esther, please feel free to take it away whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. Sorry I couldn't be there in person. I need to say first that I apologize because this is probably going to be somewhat frustrating or not very satisfying update, because there are a lot of things that we don't know still right now, and we have a lot more questions than answers at this point. I was speaking with Barbara Green a couple of weeks ago, and we had just daylighted this issue to the media, I think a couple of days before, and she expressed an interest in having a little bit of an update for this group, that folks might be curious about what's going on there and where we're at with this managing this issue. So for those of you that don't know too much about the Chimney Hollow Reservoir, it is a project that has been underway for many years in a permitting process for about 15 years, and it farms a water right on the Colorado River that takes water just downstream of the Fraser and the Colorado River down at the confluence where Windy Gap Reservoir is located. And it basically provided a dedicated storage bucket for the water rights that's used at the Windy Gap Reservoir and pump plant to bring water to the East Slope through the Colorado Big Thompson Project. So moving the water up to the Three Lakes system, Granby Reservoir, Shadow Mountain and Grand Lake, and it eventually makes its way through under the Continental Divide through the Adams Tunnel and gets stored in this new reservoir that is just about to be finalized this summer, which is Chimney Hollow Reservoir. And it's located just west of Carter Lake, west of Loveland. And it's been in construction for about 5 years. And this summer was supposed to be it's going to be the final commissioning of the reservoir. So the reservoir is actually, the dam is going to be finalized this summer. And we had plans to start moving water into Chimney Hollow Reservoir and commission the project, and in the next couple of years start delivering water out of the system. And in the kind of later stages of construction of the project, we have made discovery of uranium at the construction site. And it took, it's taken some time to first really understand, I mean, discover the issue and realize that there was a uranium issue at Chimney Hollow Reservoir. And now to really scope this issue deeper to understand what's driving this problem, where it's coming from, and then what we are going to be able to do about it. So the uranium that was found, this has nothing to do with any sort of exploration of uranium at the site or any man-made production of uranium at the site. It comes from the rocks, the geological formations that were quarried on the construction site to provide material for construction of the dam. So the uranium, it's mineral uranium that is in the granite that that was quarried to provide material for building the dam. And this was not discovered until fairly recently, and really was brought about through some proactive sampling that we carried out as a result of extreme precipitation events that occurred at the site, and that prompted us due to special operations at the site and management of the water at the site to seek to do some sampling there in case these operations were going to create some issues. We didn't know anything about the uranium. And it's through this voluntary proactive monitoring that we started finding elevated concentrations of uranium at the site. And it wasn't obvious at all initially where it was coming from, nor was it obvious either that it was going to be a persistent problem. It wasn't initially. So we're now in the process of performing much deeper investigations, both in terms of source identification and really trying to get a handle around how much uranium there is at the site, what the different targeted sources at the site are, and how this is going to interface with the water when we start putting water in the reservoir. So for now, we're not going to be releasing any water once we start putting water in the reservoir. We will not be releasing water out of the reservoir until we have a better handle on all the dynamics on site and a better understanding of what our mitigation strategies might be. In very broad terms, there are really two tracks that we're looking at in terms of mitigation strategies. One is treatment, and the other one is blending of this water when we release it. But we will not be doing we will not release any water out of the reservoir until we have fully investigated this issue and developed mitigation strategies that we're ready to implement, and we can guarantee that the uranium levels that in the delivered water are safe and acceptable for the drinking water uses that this water will go to. So just to be clear, it's not a radioactivity issue. There's really no radioactivity at the site. It's a water supply issue, and it has to do with when we fill the reservoir and the granite, crushed granite or larger size boulders that contain granite with uranium in it come in contact with the water and leach uranium into the water over time. We don't know yet how long this process is going to take and how fast the leaching is going to occur. So these are some of the things that we're looking into to try to understand how we might be also operationally managing the reservoir when water starts being brought into the reservoir. So that's pretty much the extent of what we know right now. There are a lot of questions that we're trying to answer. A lot of these investigations are being done confidentially right now. This is a sensitive issue, and we're very conscious of the concerns that this brings about when you start talking about uranium and drinking water. This is something we're taking very seriously, and we want to make sure that we're doing due diligence before we start speaking about how exactly we're going to mitigate for it. So that's my update. I'm happy to answer any questions that folks might have on this issue. It's pretty fresh. It came out a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, Tori.
Yeah. Cool. Go ahead, Tori.
Awesome. Okay. Well, Esther, good to see you online, and thanks so much for giving us that update. For the West Slope folks, you know, in particular, Grand County issued a 1041 permit for the firming project, which, you know, has West Slope implications, even though the reservoir that you're constructing is on the eastern side of the slope. Do you all anticipate that this would change anything in that 1041 permit or any of the associated agreements for the West Slope folks? As much as you might know now.
I don't think so. I mean, this is really a delivery issue. It's really a water quality issue for the recipients of this water. And that includes both the Windy Gap firming, Windy Gap participants, as well as the CBT allottees, because this water will blend with CBT water eventually when it's released. And that's where really the impacts are. If any, you know, we'll make sure that there aren't any. That's the whole point. But that doesn't really change anything west of the divide. If not that, it may change how and at what speed we fill the reservoir. I mean, that I can't answer yet. I mean, this is all very prospective, but we might, our first fill operation might look different once we figure out what makes sense to do from a mitigation standpoint than what we had anticipated initially. But I don't think that changes anything in terms of the nature of the agreements or the requirements that we have there. We'll still, you know, we'll still do what we're supposed to do there.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of what I was thinking too, but I thought it'd be nice to clarify. Yeah. Yeah.
Great. Does anybody have any questions for Esther in the room? Anybody on the Zoom? All right. Well, thank you so much, Esther. We really appreciate this informative update. And yeah, if you have any further updates, you know, in the future, we would love to host you back here and follow up, you know, once you guys get a little more information.
Yep. Happy to do so when we have more information to share.
Awesome. Thank you very much. All right, so we're moving on to our next item, which is not on the agenda, but we are lucky enough to have a visit from our water champion, Senator Roberts. My name's Waters. Senator Roberts, who is going to give us a quick little update on some of the things that he's been working on and has been going on at the state legislature. Thank you.
Commissioner, you are my commissioner, so thank you for having me, and good to see you all today. Thanks for letting me pop in. I was in the area and saw that you guys were here in Edwards, so I appreciate you being here and happy to give just a brief update on the legislative session, and then happy to take any questions, and you tell me when it's time to move on the agenda, and I'll get out of here. But for those of you that I don't know, I'm Dylan Roberts, the state senator for Senate District 8, which you are in right now. It's 10 counties in central northwest Colorado, and I am the chair of the Senate Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee, so I work on and see almost every water bill that comes through the state legislature as they go through that committee, and love working on water issues with a lot of familiar faces that I see in the room and online. And thank you. I just first want to thank you for your partnership. QQ is always a great resource for us as legislators to understand where county commissioners and other local officials are falling on these water bills and water topics. And we definitely appreciate when you come to testify and give input on the bills that are going through the legislature. As you probably saw at the legislature this year, the big overarching theme was our state budget and the difficult situation we were in with our state budget. When we walked into the doors at the beginning of January, we had to cut $1.2 billion from our state budget in order to balance, which we're constitutionally required to do. And so there was a lot of cuts that got made across various state entities. But some good news in the water world is that because the way we've set up our water financing and funding our Colorado water plan, a lot of those funds are not from the general fund. And so water actually had a very successful legislative session in terms of both policy and financing. I was proud to sponsor the annual water projects bill this year, which was the second highest it's ever been in Colorado's history. And so that's going to go funding important municipal projects, agriculture conservation, a variety of things in our water plan. That's in large part because of the two funding sources for that are severance tax and sports betting taxes. Sports betting has proven to be very popular in Colorado, and so that is good news for water, whether you partake in the sports betting or not. We also passed another bill that's going to increase our sports betting revenue significantly by eliminating the deduction that those casinos have been taking on the promotional bets. Those had been exempted from this water tax, and with House Bill 1311 that I did with Speaker McCluskey and Representative Soper, over the next 2 years, that will ratchet down to zero, so there won't be any tax exemption on those free bets. It's estimated to increase our sports betting proceeds for water by $12 million a year, so a 25% increase in that line item, which will be positive. A couple other bills to highlight, Senate Bill 40. This is a bill that will create a task force, and they're going to be making those appointments in the next couple months to study the future of severance taxes in our state and how it specifically relates to the funding of water projects. Because severance taxes are the largest source of funding for water projects right now, and the volatility of severance taxes and the Joint Budget Committee coming into the practice of sweeping severance taxes to balance the budget, we're worried that future funding for water outside of sports betting will be at risk. And so this task force is going to be charged with looking at what are some longer term solutions to funding water in Colorado. And so there is a county commissioner seat on that task force. There's a municipal seat on that task force. We'll have folks from a variety of different entities. So would love to make sure that QQ is involved in that. There's public testimony at every meeting and opportunities to provide feedback. Another exciting bill that didn't get a lot of attention, but I think will prove to be very important for groups like this, is House Bill 1115. This is going to centralize water supply forecasting and management across the state. We know there's a variety of entities that do, you know, airborne snow monitoring or groundwater measurements. This bill will consolidate all of that within the Department of Natural Resources and give everybody access to a statewide database of what is our snowpack levels, what is our water supply in various basins, and allow you to make as informed decisions as possible. And then I would just say, you know, the next thing is we're looking forward to next legislative session already. Of course, we don't get started until January, but now is the time where we're back in our communities and learning from folks on the ground. So I just wanted to invite you, of course, to always contact me, as many of you do, but reach out to us if you have ideas about things that need to be changed in your community or across the state. We would love to work with you. So that's my brief update. If anybody has any questions, I don't know if we have time, but I'm happy to take any questions or feedback. And thanks for this quick moment, Commissioner Waters.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions? Yeah, of course.
Hi, Senator Roberts. Hi. Good to see you. Laura from Gunnison County. This is a little bit of my tiny mini soapbox, so I apologize, but you're here. So it's a question about that task force that's going to study severance tax and wondering how folks can apply if they want to be on the task force. And then I think you know this, but I feel like in general, as a local county representative, I do a lot of education of the public about how we fund roads and bridges in Colorado. And we are prohibited from spending general fund monies on road and bridge maintenance. We have relied on severance tax in Gunnison County as a supplement for our road and bridge fund for a really long time. And so anytime the state starts talking about severance tax, our radar goes up and we're like, what's going to happen? And I think you probably know there's going to be a huge reduction in severance tax payments this year. We just had a study commissioned that looked at all the roads in Gunnison County. I know you've been there. You know how big it is. And we have a close to $39 million deficit in road maintenance, not to get our roads up to A level, just to get them up to like C plus level. And so it's a huge problem. And it's our like one of our core duties as local government is to ensure that road and bridge network succeeds. And so I'm wondering if you can comment a little bit on this task force, and it's looking at severance tax. And I was encouraged to hear you say potentially looking at what are other sustainable revenues for the future. I mean, how worried do I have to be about loss of severance tax? And at the same time, I'm here in QQ and we have a strategic goal around water quality and quantity. So we support water projects wholeheartedly. So trying to balance these two needs, knowing that we're all working with a limited pot of funds, and kind of how worried do I need to be about severance taxes going away?
Sure. Thank you for that. So on your first question, as far as applying or being interested in the task force, I don't have it off the top of my head, but each seat has a somebody who makes the appointment. You know, the Speaker of the House gets one appointment, the minority leader gets one appointment, the governor gets a couple. So I can follow up, but I can't recall who has the county commissioner appointment, but look that up. If anybody here is interested, either you or somebody within your organization, you can always email me and I'll get it to the right person. And we would love to have, of course, some Western Slope voices on that task force. That task force is specifically charged with looking at severance tax as it relates to water funding. So it won't necessarily have the charge to look at the other things that severance tax funds, road and bridge and you know, energy impact assistance funds, things like that. But we are, you know, if we can find a way to fund water through a different source, that frees up money for these other things. So a rising tide lifts all boats. So I think that should be a part of the conversation too. I think it's fair to be worried about severance tax for a variety of reasons. You know, it is largely based on energy extraction, which either because of market forces or because of government regulation is volatile, and some are going down in Colorado. We're also losing, you know, significant federal funding to help supplement some of those efforts as well. So I've been talking to, you know, I have Clear Creek County in my district. I have Grand County in my district. I see some commissioners online, you know, with mining revenue going down in those communities, in those counties, from the Henderson mine, and then Lake County as well with Climax. They're looking at ways to help bridge that gap, and the energy assistance impact funds are a big part of that. So we're talking about maybe some future legislation for that. One thing I want to highlight, and I know several commissioners were helpful on this, we did pass a bill. It's not related to water directly, but we expanded the ability for county lodging tax, and that it was currently capped at 2%. Now you can go to your voters and increase that all the way up to 6% if you'd like. And then we expanded the available uses for those funds. So if that could help free up some funding in your budget, that could be helpful. That's something to consider as well, but a lot of different things there.
Any questions? Oh, you're here.
Hi, thanks, Senator Roberts, for joining us today. I'm Gusty Kanakis from the town of Minturn, and we're in the process of building a new water treatment plant, and we were going to use SRF funding, and it seems like it's been cut. We've been told it might not be available. It's going to be actually, we're trying to do construction starting next year. Would any of these two funding sources that you recommended be an avenue for us to, you know, to look into?
I don't want to make any promises that I can't be aware of. I think, but there's a possibility, you know, the water projects bill, you'd have to get on that list and start applying for future years. The projects that are funded through that bill this year have already been approved and gone through that process. And then, you know, there might be some other state funding and grants available. But it's a challenge, and that, you know, to be very blunt with everybody, because of our state budget situation and because of the cuts that are likely to come from the federal level, we're going to be in a difficult place when it comes to financing. And so it's going to rely on folks getting creative of different grants or going to your voters for different revenue streams to fund those important projects. But happy to talk individually and set something up.
Thank you.
And I'll just note that QQ did pen a letter to our federal delegation regarding WSRF funding and that cut. And so we're hoping that our, you know, federal delegation and offices will be able to, you know, highlight that, because it will have severe major impacts to all of our small local jurisdictions. So that was something that QQ has done on our behalf. Does anybody have any other questions in the room or online? Awesome. Well, I guess I will thank you so much. I really do appreciate you coming to join us. And if you have any other closing thoughts, please.
No, I just echo my thanks for all of you. I see a lot of familiar faces in the room and folks on the Zoom who are real champions. And we couldn't get a lot of these bills and these ideas passed without your help. And so, again, an invitation to keep collaborating with us if you have ideas and individual asks that you need. If you need help with bugging folks at state agencies or anything like that, we're always happy to nudge things along. I see the speaker's aide is on here. The speaker, McCluskey, is, of course, a huge water champion for us in the House, and we'd love to help our communities as much as we can. So thanks for letting me come today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thank you. All right. So moving right along, so we're going to have a quick discussion. It shouldn't take too long about the QQ Legal Defense Fund. Tori, am I taking this or are you taking this?
I think it'd be great for you to summarize what the officers discussed, but would it be helpful for me to give a little history of this fund?
Maybe you start with the history real quick, and then I can give the update to where we landed.
Okay, awesome. So I know this is going to be repeat for some of you, but I can even see on my screen some folks that I haven't met yet. So we always assume that there's new folks at every meeting. So I'll start at the beginning of what this is. So QQ, for those of you that don't know, this group of elected officials, local governments, your whole consultant team work is funded through your member dues, and those are assessed annually, basically. So all the work that we do, you all sign a contract every year in the fall, and that's for us to complete a specific scope of work. And so we're not really talking about anything related to that, except that it's helpful background. So separate than that, the way that QQ started back in the 70s, and I think Barbara is having to sign off, or else I could have her give the longer history of it. So much of this is word of mouth passed down, right? Yep, she popped off. Anyway, but the way that QQ started was not this committee, didn't necessarily meet every 4 months or whatever. It really started specifically as a legal defense fund, passing the hat around to local governments in the headwaters that were impacted by Trans Mountain diversions or were worried about future Trans Mountain diversions. So that's why it's broader membership, certainly, than just those local governments at this point that were impacted by Trans Mountain diversions because of the threat of potential future Trans Mountain diversions. Anyway, so that passing of the hat is what became the Legal Defense Fund. Not really sure when, but at some point more than 15 years ago, that passing of the hat, not was capped, but somehow that fund got up to $100,000, and then it's grown because of interest to be $120,000. But QQ does have a set of bylaws, and they don't come up very much because usually QQ operates by consensus. But the one thing that's clear is that Legal Defense Fund would never be used unless QQ members basically vote or are, you know, direct the consultant team to hire somebody or do whatever we needed to do to use that Legal Defense Fund. There's not really any qualifiers of how that's used, except that it's called a Legal Defense Fund. So that signifies something. But anyway, so that money is sitting there. In the 13 years that I've worked for QQ, we've never used that. We've never tapped that money. So when certain legal issues have arisen, for example, we thought we might need to tap it, but we ended up being able to work within our consultant contract for big oil and gas rulemakings that threatened local authority to regulate for environmental issues. That's something that QQ was worried about. Or some of the negotiated agreements, 1041 permits that that Esther talked about earlier for the Windy Gap firming project in Grand County, and also some of the work QQ did to support Grand County and other signatories of the Colorado River Cooperative Agreement. Those were some big lifts, but at the same time, we were able to do that under our existing consultant fee. Just so you have some background on the fact that that has never been used in the past. So Nina, I'll kick it over to you because, you know, I think since I've been here 13 years, no one's kind of asked the question, and I think it's a good one for you all to think about the adequacy of that legal defense fund as it stands now. And so I think it was a good question that the officers brought up last, I think it maybe it was two QQ meetings ago, like in the fall of 2024. And then I think members asked the officers to discuss it from there. And so that's kind of where we are now. And I'll kick it over to you, Nina.
Yeah, thank you. So it was Tori's right that I had raised the question about, actually, it was actually not in a QQ meeting, remember? It was in a Northwest COG meeting. And I was asking, we were going over the budget. And I don't know a lot about, I'm no lawyer, but I do know that in the grand scheme of a legal case, $100,000 to me seemed like a very small drop in a very big bucket. And it was really on the highlight of the reason why I really was thinking about it was when Eagle County was filing their lawsuit regarding the new railway. And I was thinking about like, what would that look like for QQ? So we met together a few weeks ago to discuss whether or not this was something that we wanted to start talking about as an organization as a whole. And we kind of settled on the decision that, you know, we don't know still what kinds of conflicts or issues in which we might want to engage in at a higher legal kind of standard. Like Tori had mentioned, a lot of the things that are included in that consult fee does include a lot of, we filed an amicus brief, I believe, right? On behalf of that case, right, Tori?
And so that all can- coalition.
Oh, so as a, we like, joined the coalition. We didn't
file. Yeah, and that could be like the thing that we may have to draw from the legal defense fund if we were to write our own Supreme Court brief. You know, that's an example, or amicus brief, because we would need outside legal expertise to do something.
Exactly. Like. Yeah. So that's kind of the way that we, and since we're small and we stay so nimble as a regularity, I think we kind of decided that right now with, you know, how budgets are kind of shaping up, at least I can speak only for my county, things are getting tougher and tougher each year. And so we decided that in the event that something comes up, that would be the time in which we would, you know, a county has a need for, or a group of counties has a need that needs legal representation, and we want to pull on that legal defense fund. That would be when we started doing that. And then we would start to pass the hat if there's any implications for your local jurisdiction. But yeah, Greg, is there anything else that I might have missed? Exactly.
Can you repeat that? We can't hear.
Yes, we'll do.
Without the microphone.
Yeah, Greg was. Greg had just noted that, you know, in the event that an issue comes up, then we would be able to quickly call on our neighboring counties or other members of QQ to step in if necessary. And so, I would love to open this up, though, if there is any follow-up comment, discussion, thoughts about the direction in which we're going regarding this one topic. Nada? Anybody online? Great.
Well, great. That's good news. Oh, wait, I got C1 in the back. I'll bring it over. I got it.
Did you discuss what amount you thought was more appropriate?
We didn't. I don't think we did discuss what amount it would have been, because it varies dependent on whatever that issue, may it be quality or quantity. I think those are two very different kind of cases. And so we didn't really discuss it. I think it might be worth kind of taking a look, and maybe we can ask Barbara or and or Tori to see if there's been any other cases that they could give us some reasonable ideas about what something like that would cost, so that we can just have it in our back pocket. But maybe no. Okay.
It's hard. I think that the important thing is, like, at least from listening to you all and from what we discussed, we feel like we could do it totally on a case by case basis. Ashley, I wonder if you remember how much we ended up doing a passing of the hat for the molybdenum issues before the Water Quality Control Commission. But I think that's a really good example of something ad hoc where we could have asked all the QQ members, but the molybdenum issue is pretty specific to Summit County. So we did a passing the hat of interested members in Summit County, but also because the issue affected Denver Water, Denver Water ended up contributing 50% of the cost of hiring these toxicologists to help us with the rulemaking. And then local governments in Summit County basically fronted up the other half. And so we will always work to broaden the circle to reduce impacts to you all, but also to bring more people into the fold as it makes sense to our argument too. So anyway, that's an example to me, but I have no idea how much we ended up.
I can jump in with the cost story. Retaining the two toxicologists was roughly $20,000, and Denver Water footed half the bill. So I think each member group that participated paid roughly $2,000 apiece. And then your time and my time was, of course, covered under our typical contract.
Yeah, so it kind of depends. Like, it's a case by case, issue by issue. And if that feels comfortable, you know, great. Maybe if I can, just can we get just for voting members of QQ, kind of like a thumbs up, middle thumbs, or down thumbs, if this feels like a comfortable direction? I see lots of thumbs up. Great. Great. Well, great. Sounds good. No, we're not going to be passing the hat quite yet, but just you wait. Anything can happen. All right. So let's keep on moving along. Do we want to take this time to do our consultant updates? Is this when we're going to be, or is this a different? Oh, is that later on? Member discussion of federal executive orders and policies. So I do think that, Tori, you're going to be taking this one.
Maybe. Sure. Yeah, I can help kick this off. I don't have a lot of updates from we left some time on the last agenda. Barbara did a more a broader, I guess I'll say, kind of freewheeling, like, here's where we are with the situation that we know of in the administration. I did not prepare kind of such something just as broad as Barbara, but we really wanted to leave a lot of time on the agenda for members to share what's going on with you all and how you're approaching some of the dramatic changes that are happening under this administration. In particular, I guess I will fold this into one of my updates, but I think in particular, the one place that we are seeing a lot of change, I think, since our last QQ meeting is the level of environmental review that would happen under under NEPA review, or the National Environmental Policy Act, environmental impact statements and EAs, environmental assessments. Anyway, there's been some executive orders to, and then some administrative rulemaking initiated also to expedite certain activities under NEPA, in particular energy extraction projects. And so that's associated with the Unleashing American Energy
executive order that was in place even before our last QQ meeting. But there have been some ancillary, you know, spinoff things that have happened from there in the last few months. And at least with some of our clients that we work with directly, local governments, it has triggered some desire to look at local regulations and see if, you know, make sure basically your regulations are adequately asking an applicant to analyze impacts of a project. Some of that information you may have been relying on from an EIS may not look like what you're used to anymore. And so there certainly are lots of reasons to be reevaluating your regulations, but in particular, recalling that local regulations that address environmental impacts of private activity, in particular on public land, local governments can regulate private activities on public land. And so as we see federal regulations weakening in particular for those types of projects, we're curious and we just really wanted to leave some time on the agenda for folks to share experiences of if you're looking at your regulations, you know, focusing on that since we're at a QQ meeting, but also realizing that the breadth of what's happening. Natural resources may not always be at the top, but I think for us, it's a good time to think about the work that you're doing on you know, how you're regulating potential projects on public land that may not be regulated federally the same way that they were. And then the only other thing I'll add to that NEPA discussion, we sent out an email about this a couple of weeks ago, but the question of what is covered under NEPA is further complicated because of the recent Supreme Court decision on the Uinta railway case. That's what Nina mentioned, that QQ participated in an amicus brief led by Glenwood Springs. Many of you in this room were also participated in that amicus brief, but Eagle County was one of the chief parties that brought the lawsuit against the federal government for their permitting of the Uinta Railroad Project, which is a railroad project that would really be built. There's no one's really saying that it would be built for anything except to extract oil and oil shale from the Uinta Basin in Utah, and then send that on a new line, the Uinta Basin Railway line. And then it would come through Colorado to Denver, where it could be sent down to oil refineries in Texas. And so anyway, that case was questioning the adequacy of the environmental impact statement conducted by the Surface Transportation Board, which is who needed to approve this new rail line. And the Supreme Court said, The new standard, basically, the Supreme Court said the EIS was adequate. The plaintiffs lost their argument, and now the case is going to be remanded to the lower court to see what needs to happen next. But the new thing is that the Supreme Court basically said that the agency that's conducting the NEPA analysis receives broad deference as to what types of impacts need to be analyzed under NEPA. So Eagle County was saying this EIS was inadequate because they failed to analyze impacts downstream along the rail line. I don't think downstream is probably confusing when you're talking about a river because it actually moves upstream, but the downline impacts of the project to the neighboring state, Colorado. There were environmental groups who were also claiming that the EIS was inadequate because also the EIS failed to analyze, or the agency failed to analyze impacts all the way down the line to the oil refineries in Texas and the impacts that additional oil would pose there. I think I'll just say that I think most folks were very worried about that long of a chain of indirect impacts all the way down the line. If you're building one new rail line and you have to like tease out that the rail line is for oil and gas or oil, but that's not you know, the service transportation boards only approving the rail line itself. And then also not only that is like you have to move all the way down the line to get to the oil refineries in Texas. So many folks were worried about that line of argument. And so something that the amicus brief focused on and Eagle County tried to focus on separately, but wasn't able to give oral arguments separately was that at least they should have looked at impacts to the neighboring state where the, you know, the next line over from the new line that's constructed, basically. Interestingly, the Supreme Court didn't even, I mean, from my reading, they pretty much wholesale ignored Eagle County's argument. And so while we know that a lot of deference now goes to the state agency as to what type of impacts have to be analyzed, there's still a question as to, it's not like we know that you don't have to analyze impacts of like a neighboring state, for example. It's not that clear. And a lot of that is going to be teased out at the lower court. In the meantime, there's also a question as to how this streamlining of NEPA might affect the underlying case, I think, that was brought by Eagle County and the environmental groups. So anyway, tying that back to what's going on, this broad agenda item of the administration, I think the big takeaway from NEPA is it really puts a lot more. So the agencies are directed to expedite NEPA to I would say reduce the scope of what they're looking at by the administration. And at the same time, the Supreme Court has said, we're going to defer to what the agencies are doing. So you've lost some of that judicial review of what the statute says that you have to do because of NEPA. So anyway, that I think that's the biggest change that since our last QQ meeting. And like I said, I really wanted to just tease this out, but hopefully we just left a lot of time on the agenda for you all to talk and share about some of your efforts, your concerns. And the last thing I'll say is if anybody sees a need for it, it is possible for QQ to members only to go into an executive session if there is something that's of legal sensitive nature that we needed to do that. So I'll offer that too, but I haven't heard any, you know, like we can just deal with that if we hear something. So.
Yeah. So does anybody online or in the room have any tips, tricks, good things that they're willing to share about what's going on in their local jurisdictions? Rewarding any reactions to EOs or other policies? Crickets.
Is anybody at their natural resource regulations? Like, do you have that slated at all for work session? Have you thought about it at all? Especially counties, I think.
Well, I can speak kind of broadly about Summit County. As some of you may or may not know, 80% of our territory is U.S. Forest Service land. So we focus really, whenever a lot of these EOs come, we try to have biannual meetings with our large land managers, such as the BLM, CPW, and the U.S. Forest Service. But within that meeting, you know, our supervisor, the White River supervisor, is a new addition to the team. And in our last great productive meeting, you know, they basically told us within that meeting to really don't be really thoughtful about our comments when it comes to any of those EIS lookouts, and make sure that, you know, feel free to invite them. They are really looking out for what you as the local government is trying to make happen and or protect. And so pepper them with questions, give them a reason to create opportunities for stronger protections is kind of how they phrased it to us. So if that helps in any way, shape or form, really call up your supervisors, call up your district rangers. And if you haven't had a meeting with them, I would highly suggest you do so. I see online, we've got Randy George from Grand County.
Yes, Tori asked if we'd at least been thinking about doing some things regarding controlling developments, particularly in our case, we were looking at the oil and gas development in certain areas of the county and had discussions with the Colorado Oil and Gas Association and also our federal congressional representatives about things and trying to actually have a federal mineral rights withdrawal. It did not seem that that was appropriate at this time politically, so we are wanting to investigate more about what we can do as a county to make sure we have good controls in place to protect not only the water, but also to protect a lot of the recreational and viewscapes that are so important in our mountain communities. So we're working that direction. We haven't got very far yet, but we hope to over this next year.
Thanks so much for sharing. I got a comment in the room.
Hi, Laura Hartman with Eagle County. I'll just say that we are having a lot of conversations about these federal actions and kind of what our strategy will be. We've signed on to a lot of letters, to send a lot of letters on our own, communicating with our federal delegates, just like all the other counties are doing. But we have a special work session on public lands on July 1st, and we're going to be discussing the potential to have a public lands resolution and gathering information and direction from our commissioners to inform a public lands plan, which Callie and Marcia are leading the charge on.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Can I add on to Laura? This is Marcia.
Go for it, Marcia.
Hi, Marcia Gillis, Director of Open Space Natural Resources. Thank you for giving all that information. The other piece that I will say that we're looking at with potential for, you know, the current legislation with the Big Beautiful Bill and any potential for public land sell off. I know that the attorney's office is looking at how to strengthen our what is known right now as backcountry zoning for those federal lands. But how can we put in more limitations or protections there in our land use regs? So more to come on that. I'm not sure where that conversation is currently.
Thanks, Marcia. That's really great to know.
Hi, not going to say anything new, but we did pass a public lands resolution in Gunnison County. So if that's helpful to Eagle County, we're happy to share it. We certainly didn't invent it. It was based on other resolutions that we've seen, but modified it for our particular context. So happy to share that. I have some time scheduled with our attorney and our community development director to talk about exactly what Tori was referring to, is like taking a look at our own regulations and where do they intersect with the state regulations and with the federal processes. But honestly, Tori, we haven't done that yet. I mean, I think you prompted us at the last meeting and I was like, oh, we should do that. So we're still working on it. But a lot of, we haven't talked about the other places the federal government is making big changes to local government and delivery of services. But like a lot of our time is being consumed in talking about, how are people going to have enough food to eat? So that's where a lot of our energy is going, is like food, Medicaid, rural hospitals, rural medical care. Public land sell off, that's a big issue. And there's only so much we can do at the county level, right? We can't like magically backfill these federal programs. But I think, you know, the issues you guys raise are really important, and we're trying to be responsive to all the other things that are happening. The AmeriCorps cuts were pretty big. And then we got those AmeriCorps positions back, which is great. One thing we did do locally is fund for recreation seasonal staff for the Forest Service through a local nonprofit. The county did not fund that effort, but there was a coalition of folks in the community that put together funds, including our local municipalities. And we have a outdoor recreation committee that put some money into it. So there are a handful of things we're trying to do to allay some of the negative impacts from some of these decisions. But certainly things like we had winter travel management on the horizon, and now it seems like that's not going to happen for a while. So anyway, not a lot to share, but happy to share that resolution if it's useful.
Thanks, Laura.
Awesome. I should add that if you all are starting to look at some of those regs, Laura, Nina, you know, we're happy to bounce. I think we have some, you know, ability with QQ to help you look at some of those if you want to just get, you know, a quick take on it.
Yeah, don't forget, you pay dues. So please use our stuff at your leisure. Reasonable leisure. I think I'm just curious to know amongst the group, is there, if there is anybody, if you are interested, would it be helpful for us to draft any sort of memo or examples of, you know, regulations or anything that's going on that we're hearing about? Yeah, Greg, he's getting the mic.
Yeah, I'm hearing a lot of similarity from other counties, mm-hmm. and it might be great if QQ could just help collate that so we all know what everyone's doing. We've hired a couple of extra deputies through our sheriff. Our open space program is bringing on additional rangers. We're trying to figure out how to reverse the loss of about 40 volunteers at the Maroon Bells Wilderness Area, which is super heavily impacted. People that were working for free who've been let go because the Forest Service can't manage them. And so they've had to abandon their water system. You know, water and a power at the Maroon Bells means there's no usable toilet facilities. And so it's kind of turning into a cascade of, a mess in the making. And so we're trying to work on all that. And we are working at the same time with our attorneys on land use policy, things we can do as overlays. And I think it sounds like Eagle's doing it. If you're doing it in Gunnison, it might be helpful for QQ to collate that information. Yeah, and maybe we can come up with a standard response or a policy that could help us convince the Forest Service to let us work with them to bring back those volunteers that we rely on now.
Yeah, no, I can't agree more.
Yeah, and then the last thing was just regarding the, you know, backfilling. We have the ability to backfill. Perhaps we're lucky enough to do that in Pitkin County a bit more, but everyone's afraid to think, well, if we start paying for this, that means the feds won't ever pay for it again. And I have to say, it's like holding up the puppy to shoot the puppy. You know, it's like, I'm going to shoot this puppy. If you know, it doesn't make sense to me. It's like, we have to do what we have to do to protect our resources. And I'm just hoping that argument, though, let's not do anything because we don't want them to think we can afford it. It just doesn't make sense to me. So that's part of what's going on in my head as we try to backfill things and find ways around it going forward for maybe what, 4 more years, 20 years, how long will it take to get out of this?
Yeah, no, I can't agree more. We in Summit County, we've been paying for some of our front country rangers on behalf of the U.S. Forest Service for years now. And, the authority to hire those workers actually was taken away from us, but we were able to get that back. And while it is a cost that, you know, some of us can stand to bear, we have a dedicated funding source towards that. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to talk about that. But at the end of the day, what is our jobs? And our jobs is to protect the resources that our constituents have voted us or appointed us to do that by. So, yeah, I'm happy to discuss with Tori and staff and see about what we can do to collate some best practices, some things that we have found helpful and useful. And if you have anything, maybe you start to distribute that or send that over to Anna and she'll collate it all together and we'll have a discussion about it.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. We're happy to do that. We actually, Barbara and I were texting because we have some young people working with our law firm this summer and through next year. But I think they could
they could be perfect to start that effort. And then I always think that the value, you know, we're happy to do that, but I think we're looking for feedback also on, you know, the next step. I think it would be helpful for you all to talk to each other because, you know, we can collate that information, but you all are the ones doing the work. It's not us. So, you may benefit, you know, we're happy to just, you know, schedule a call with county natural resource folks or, you know, just looking for feedback on what kind of group would like to get together. And we're happy to convene that because I think, you know, at the end of the day to tell us and have us pass it on, we're happy to do that to start the conversation. But I just think talking about what's working, what's not, sharing your experiences could be helpful too.
For Eagle County, I wanted to provide an update on our Front Country Ranger program. Commissioner Waters, you reminded me that there were issues with hiring seasonals to fund that program. And so what we did was worked with AmeriCorps to fill those positions. And that is a program that's funded by Eagle County, but all the municipalities within Eagle County contribute to that fund as well. The other thing that I believe it was announced last week is through partnership with Vail Valley Trails Mountain Alliance, we received a GOCO grant, and those funds will be used to do restoration projects, trail closures, other natural resource angled projects on county, municipality, but also federal land. So we're hoping to put some focus on BLM lands through that project.
Yeah, and that reminds me about our Front Country Ranger. We did have to do some tricky accounting in order to and hire them through a local nonprofit that works with our Forest Service. So just be prepared that you're going to have to, not tricky, just it's got to be coming from a different source other than your local government, we found.
That's a good point. We also worked with VVMTA, that Trails Alliance, to start the first ever Eagle County Youth Corps. So through those GOCO funds, we hope to also expand that and continue that going and build momentum for some of that funding.
Great. Well, I think it was, rather than just kind of hang out, we'll move forward within the agenda. We've got a time allocated for discussion of other QQ issues as needed. I would love to give this opportunity, though, over to Ashley if she feels comfortable kind of going over our 208 plan updates. Do you want to do it from there?
Oh, sorry. Thank you both. All right. So today's updates won't focus directly on the 208 plan itself, but they focus on elements that will be covered in the 208 plan. And these are largely updates on recent progress at the Water Quality Control Division or Water Quality Control Commission. So the first thing I'd like to share with you all is that in late June, the Water Quality Control Division sent surveys to potential municipal separate stormwater system permittees. So these are small systems. And the purpose of the survey is to assess stormwater management in smaller communities. Some, but not all of these communities will become MS4 permittees. So the survey recipients were identified based on total population, population density, and seasonal populations. And the seasonal population is how 16 communities in the QQ region were entrained into the survey process. So if you'd like me to read the list of survey recipients, I can, but well, I'm going to go ahead and do it anyways because the remainder of my update is relevant. Gunnison, Edwards, Avon, urban area, so not in those community boundaries. Avon, Vail, Minturn, Fraser, the Fraser urban area, Granby, Winter Park, Aspen, Snowmass Village, Keystone, Silverthorne, Breckenridge, Dillon, and Frisco. So if you represent one of these communities, were you aware of the survey? All right, great, good. Anybody else? Yeah. So the question or the survey is what, roughly 8 questions, Pete and PJ? Yep. And not particularly difficult questions, but I would say time consuming is how I would characterize it. We're here to help if you need help tracking down water quality data, identifying your receiving waters, that type of thing. Pete and PJ, is there anything you'd like to add?
Did that work?
Can someone online let us know if you can hear Pete?
Not hear Pete yet.
Yeah, they were definitely in-depth questions, and we felt a need to try to answer them in great detail to try to provide all the information we could that might influence the department's decision. I mean, the gist of it is they've historically assigned MS4 permits to municipalities with a population over 10,000. Through this process, I discovered that Vail has, 4,800 and shrinking full-time residents, but we have about 5,000 second homeowners and 19,000 hotel and Airbnb beds. So if they choose to include all of that as though we are well over the 10,000. But I wanted to try to include a lot to indicate that a lot of our stormwater impact comes from Interstate 70, and that's not really us. A lot of the questions were about how much developable land remains in the municipality and what some of the big development projects are. And again, Vail's built out, its I-70 projects are really the mass of it. So we're just trying to highlight all of that stuff. It's definitely a time-consuming eight or 10 questions.
Agreed. And the other thing that I wanted to bring to everyone's attention while we're here, I think the urban areas, so Edwards and Avon, and then Fraser, those surveys likely would have been sent to county staff. And so I wanted to bring it to the attention of Eagle and Grand County that just make sure those don't get lost in the shuffle. And you may need to collaborate with, I don't know, a number of colleagues. The surveys are due July 21st. I did confirm that with the division. There was a discrepancy in their emails and survey materials. And then on a related note, the division is starting a stakeholder outreach process for the small MS4 permit renewal. That first meeting will occur on July 30th, and there's an email sign up with the division that I can circulate after the meeting. But the purpose of that meeting, as I understand it, is to educate prospective permittees and to begin soliciting input for the permit renewal process. The last time this permit was renewed it took a couple of years from 2011 to 2014, and there are over 12,000 comments statewide. So this is going to be an onerous process. And I think if you're potentially going to be regulated, you should consider engaging or at least stay in touch with me because I'll be monitoring that process. Any questions on MS4 before we move on?
Yep. Ashley. Maybe everybody knows this, but in case they don't, do you want to explain to these communities what regulation could mean for them?
That was a bit further than I felt comfortable getting into at this meeting. If there's interest, we can have a separate meeting to discuss that a little bit further. To put it simply, people who already have existing strong stormwater protection measures like Aspen and Vail, they're likely meeting nearly all of the MS4 permit requirements at this stage. And then I can't speak to where other communities would be. So that was kind of why we tabled it for now.
Yeah, I think then I'll just add for anybody that is unsure that it could mean quite a bit of regulation and compliance and expenditures and staff, infrastructure upgrades, regulations on development community, construction impacts, things like that. So it can, the results of the department's decision on this could have significant impacts for your community. So using QQ's assistance in completing the survey could be, and taking that seriously, it could be very valuable for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so seeing, go ahead.
Sorry, Ashley, you mentioned that July 30th stakeholder engagement. Where can we find out more about that?
The division is organizing that process, and I'll send out the sign-up information they shared with me.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
All yeah, right, and so Ashley, I think I kind of missed if you said this at the beginning, but Ashley just got that list of who would have even been sent these surveys like yesterday. And yes. So I think our thinking is that we're not just going to tell you all at this meeting, but we'll also do some individual outreach to folks on that list to make sure they know too. So we'll keep in touch as we know more.
Yeah, exactly. So next we'll be transitioning to a quick discussion about temperature. About this time last year, a subset of the QQ membership created what we called like a permit issues work group. And we met a handful of times. But more recently, Eagle River Water and Sanitation District reached out to Tori and I about convening a meeting of our interested members to discuss temperature standards and compliance issues. And I reached out to the permit issues group that convened last year and invited all of those folks. We've selected a meeting time of July 17th from 3 to 4, and anyone here is welcome to join us if you're not already on the list. And you know, this is just a chance to hear from Eagle River Water and Sand and a number of the Eagle County members that have had many concerns regarding temperature standards and then their implementation in permits. This table in the center of the room is filled with a lot of Town of Eagle folks that we know are all too familiar with this challenge. And so if you guys want to jump in with additional background on any process, but that was my understanding, was that you're still waiting. Yep. I was hoping that you had like a verbal agreement or something. So is there anyone in the room who's interested in attending that temperature issues meeting that's not already invited? Okay, I'm seeing Chelsea, so I'll make a quick note of that. All right, moving on. Regulation 84, which is the state's water reuse regulation. There will be a hearing in May of 2026 to consider authorizing the use of treated effluent from wastewater treatment facilities for snowmaking applications. This project or this proposal is coming from a developer in the Rout County area, and potentially there's applications elsewhere in the region. So we will be monitoring the rulemaking process. Any questions regarding that? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Stagecoach. All right. And then the next update relates to Regulation 102, which establishes the fees that the Water Quality Control Division charges for issuing permits, and then Regulation 61, which is the permitting regulation itself. There are a number of things up for consideration in the hearing that will occur in October. The notice will be published shortly, and we're keeping an eye on that. But the things that I'd like to share with you all today are the division has committed to issuing what they're calling a preliminary draft permit prior to issuing draft permits to individually permitted facilities. So generally facilities discharging over 1 MGD per day. I'm hopeful that this will help resolve some of the permitting issues that we've had, but I'm curious to see how it plays out. And then another part in that hearing is a proposal from the Wastewater Utility Council to allow modifications for administratively continued permits. So during this upcoming hearing process, we're going to keep an eye on those items. And, you know, if you all have concerns, please feel free to reach out. But it's my understanding that, generally speaking, these would help reduce the permitting challenges we've had in recent years. And then finally, in the legislature this year, Senate Bill 25305, the Water Quality Permitting Efficiency Bill, was signed into law, and along with recent updates to Reg 102, directed the Water Quality Control Division to gather stakeholders to evaluate the permitting process, focusing on three objectives. First, to improve communication with permittees. Second, to develop standardized timeframes to evaluate applications for each permit type. So essentially establishing a more formal completeness process for their applications. And then to develop a feasible permit backlog reduction schedule. So I was asked to join the steering committee to help facilitate the stakeholder outreach. And so I'm doing that. And I really want to encourage members, like, let us know what types of challenges you're having, what solutions are out there, and how we can communicate with others to, like, bring as many people into this process as possible. So, yeah, any further questions on these updates? Okay. Well, thank you all.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you so much, Ashley. Much appreciated. All right. So here is our opportunity to give member updates. So how we usually do this is we just go around the room. We'll pass the mic. We can start. You know what? Let's start online first, because we've been starting in the room quite a bit. If anybody has any updates from their locale, we can just,
hey, Nina, I had a couple of other updates.
Oh, like, you do. Sorry, Tori.
Too, but I'm go like, for since it. You've been Why to the online start... people, maybe I could just jump in first, if that's okay.
Why don't we start with QQ member update
Okay. Overall,
and then we'll segue into any individual updates if anybody feels like sharing.
Okay. Awesome. All right. Well, thanks. I just have a couple, but I wanted to let you all know that, we attended a workshop a couple of weeks ago. So QQ does monitor the legislative session, potential bills coming up at the Colorado legislature. And as part of that work, we have been hearing that there's a coalition. They've named themselves the Stream Access Coalition, but there is a group getting together to explore some sort of a bill that we're hearing next year that would relate to clarifying, I'm not sure if I should do air quotes, but clarifying or establishing a reasonable amount of access that may be allowed for river recreation, that may or may not include walkway fishing, as well as access. I mean, it's hard to know the scope at this point, but it may just be for rafting and some sort of reasonable access for portage, for emergency response type access to public land, which currently right now it's unclear that would be legal. It may be tried to be broader and be waiting, but I wanted to let you all know, because you may be hearing things that we aren't, but we're Water Congress, Colorado Water Congress convened a work session last week, and I think they're going to convene a number of other work sessions. And then we know we work regularly with a lot of the nonprofits that are considering running the legislation too. So we'll definitely stay up to speed and keep you all updated on that potential legislation for next year.
we know that there is an upcoming rulemaking in December that we've been tracking for many months now. And that is a rulemaking that builds on top of the state legislature establishing a state dredge and fill program. So that's to regulate the dredging and filling of materials into state waters that are not otherwise covered by federal permitting. And many of you will remember that there was a Supreme Court decision that narrowed the scope of what type of federal waters, waters of the U.S., require permitting for dredging and filling of those waters. And so it's a much narrower scope. That means some waters were not covered under the Federal Clean Water Act Section 404 permitting. And so the states stepped in and is starting their own program for what they call the gap waters, those that are no longer covered under federal permitting, and really any state waters that are not covered under the federal permit program. So we're tracking that rulemaking. It's going to happen in December. There are all sorts of lovely stakeholder groups that are ongoing. One of our chief focuses that I don't think anybody else is doing, like QQ is doing, is making sure that your regulations that that address impacts to wetlands are not affected by this state rulemaking. We understand that that's not the intent of the rulemaking, but we still want to make sure every step of the way that local regulations, as you may have them on the books or as you may want to do in the future, are not impacted. And that's, you know, even more important right now with federal questions of the degree of regulation.
Right. That would be, for example, if your regulations track the federal definition of wetlands versus your own definition of wetlands. And that would be vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction about how you think about that. But if you're tracking federal definitions right now in your regulations of wetlands, that's become extremely narrowed, as Tori was explaining before, as to what falls under the 404 program. I think all of you know when Tori was talking about federal permitting, she meant the existing 404 program is what it's known by. I think all of you have had to get permits or have been involved in projects that require permits under 404.
Cool. Thanks, Barbara. Two more quick updates. So just a reminder to folks that we do have a grant. QQ is working on a grant to update its 2012 study, which is water and its importance to the headwaters economies. I think I have that memorized at this point. But that is a 2012 study that's been used all over the place. Like, I know that Senator Roberts would have received, because I did it maybe 6 years ago, but I gave a presentation about water and its value to the headwaters economy, for example, to the water committee of the legislature. So we've used that study all over the place. It's outdated. There's a few things that we wish that we'd always focused on more in that study. And so there's a consulting firm that's an economics firm that's working on that. We're hoping that that's finished by the end of the year. I'm knocking on wood as I say that. But thank you to so many of you in the room who participated in interviews with that consulting firm. They're in the throes of interviewing, drafting, all that good stuff right now. So just a reminder that that's in the works. And you'll hear more about it, hopefully, at our fall meeting. The last thing I want to do is a screen share, because last week, you all received recognition from the Sonoran Institute. The Sonoran Institute celebrated its 35th year with a really fun party in Denver. And Sonoran Institute recognized its partners over the years. And QQ was recognized because, in particular, because of the work that we've done to partner with the Sonoran Institute through the Growing Water Smart trainings. They host trainings, three-day trainings. Raise your hand in the room if you've been. I know there's some people in the room that have been to some. I facilitated some way back. Oh, it raises its hand for me. Back probably 7 years ago when Growing Water Smart was first started, you all convened the first regional Growing Water Smart, and now they have them all over the state. The River District funds the West Slope region to do Growing Water Smart trainings for municipalities, counties to to develop action plans to be basically more water conservation, water conscious in their land use codes. We've also worked with the Sonoran Institute on the Bridging the Gap project that explored water transfers and case studies on what worked and what didn't work on past water transfers that include Trans Mountain diversions in the headwaters. Also some East Slope, like by and dry type water transfer projects as well. So we sent that out. We heard a lot more about that at our last QQ meeting, Bridging the Gap. But if that's not familiar to you, you can always hit up Anna. She can share that report with you all. Thank you to Greg and April for making the trek to accept the award. We had a lot of fun. And Barbara is a longtime board member of the Sonoran Institute. And is always bridging the gap with QQ and the work that we do in Sonoran Institute, bridging those things together. And Barbara was recognized for all of her hard work with the Sonoran Institute as well. So I wanted to show you that great picture, and you all should be very proud of your work. And that's it.
Thank you, Tori. So we can go around online. I'll just kind of call you out as I see you. First name I see on my list is Grand County. Randy, do you guys have any member updates?
Don't have anything dramatic to lay before you today. We've worked on some things to try to acquire some water rights, and that's hit a big wrinkle right at the moment. We're hoping to sort all that out, but we continue to work through our Open Lands, Rivers and Trails Fund, which has been very helpful in supporting our acquisition of water and also of lands adjacent to live water.
Thank you, Randy. Next I have Elle from the Speaker McCluskey's office. Do you have any updates? Oh, it says be right back. Be right back. There's a time clock. Gunnison County, do we want Hillary or Laura to give an email? Okay, great. We'll move over to the town of Crested Butte. Carolyn, do you have any updates?
Yes. Hi, everyone. So we are working on the Wildfire Ready Action Plan, and that is supported by the CWCB funds grant. And then, so that area, we've identified Coal Creek as our highest wildfire area. And we continue to have planning team meetings and looking at public meetings and stakeholder meetings in this summer. And we've had two already meetings. So that is going really well. And we're working through that. And then we are also doing alternative water source. And both of these projects came out of our source water protection plan that was with Colorado Rural Water Association. And the alternative water source, today we're doing the wetland assessment. And next week we continue to have work done to identify where our best locations for exploratory wells will be. And we'll drill those this October, and then we'll do some drawdowns and information on that to figure out our best location. And next year we'll be working on design of the well once we've identified a location for our alternative water source. And the alternative water source is because where our water comes now, Coal Creek, is our highest wildfire area. So we're just trying to identify how we could have an emergency source or alternative. And then another great thing is we actually were at the International AWWA ACE conference, and we had a poster there to show our source water protection. So that's all on water for now. Thanks.
Thank you. Next I have on, I've got Abigail.
Hi, I don't have any updates for the group, but thank you, Nina.
Great. And then Kristen, do you have any updates?
I do not, thank you.
Great. Last one online we have is Julie from Rep. Nagusa's office. Do you have any updates to share?
Sure. I have a few updates that are kind of water adjacent. On May 27th, Congressman Nagusa introduced legislation to reinstate all of the National Parks and Forest Service staff that have been removed from the agency through DOGE cuts. And then on, let's see, earlier this month, the congressman reintroduced a package of wildfire bills that are based on recommendations from the National Wildfire Coalition. So it would work to institute a lot of the recommendations that came out of that commission to advance and improve wildfire resilience and mitigation and response. And so thanks to many organizations, jurisdictions in the room who have signed on to endorse that. And the congressman has also expressed his concerns, deep concerns about the proposal in the Senate reconciliation bill to sell off millions of acres of public land. And so he's focused on fighting against that proposal.
Greatly appreciated, Julie. Thank you. Send the representative our thanks. All right, so we'll move over to the room. I will start in this back corner. Eagle County updates?
I think we've provided quite a few updates today for Eagle County. I think the main thing I want to highlight is we are updating our land use code. I think we've brought this up for the last four meetings, but the chapters are actually out there. You're able to comment on them through our website. The next chapter that's going to be released is chapter 4. I'm hoping that comes out by the end of this month, but that is something where it is heavily focused on natural resources and will be of the most value to this group to comment on for anyone of interest in the room.
Is that Callie? I just can't see who's talking in the, you're just a little bit out of the screen.
Sorry, yes, Callie Rand, Eagle County.
Okay, thanks, Callie.
Heather with High Country Conservation Center in Summit County. I think the news since last time is we did receive a CWCB grant to develop a comprehensive countywide turf replacement program to build on the successful pilot program that we launched in 2024. So that's exciting. We also still plan to update our regional water efficiency plans this year for the region and also for four individual towns, including Breck, Dillon, Frisco, and then Copper Mountain Metro District. So we are confident that we have the Bureau of Reclamation funds that they said they were going to give us, but we still don't have those in our ASAP account, but everything's been moving forward. And I've reached out to a couple of folks that just kind of help keep an eye on what's going on with our funds and why they're moving so slow, but I'm confident that we are still moving forward with that.
I'll interrupt real quick just to finish up on a couple of other updates on behalf of Summit County. So we are also in the process of our Wildfire Ready Watersheds Action Plan. We had a great stakeholdering meeting with industry first and then with the general community abroad yesterday. Really great turnout, so that's really exciting. We've got some great assets and values that we've identified. Now we just got to find the money to pay for any projects. And then we are also in the process of updating our comprehensive plan. It's one of the larger comprehensive updates that we've done in the past few years. So we are that will be coming to the Board of County Commissioners in the coming weeks. We are hoping to integrate some water efficiency planning in that comprehensive plan. So I'm looking forward to that. And then I have a question for the group. And if anybody has any feedback or thoughts, I would love to hear it after this. We have a fairly high AMI set for Summit County at large.
due to our naturally high cost of living being a rural resort community. But we also have a smaller rural remote community north of Silverthorne that has just completed a sewer study with the town, as well as looking into trying to revamp some of their fire protection water for fire and emergency services. And because of Summit County's high AMI, area median income, or average median income, they are ineligible for a lot of like the WSRF funds and things of that nature. And so I was wondering if anybody has ever navigated this, because most of that community is retirees and those on fixed incomes. So trying to figure out what are the best ways we can approach either trying to get more grant funding or relooking at that AMI for that specific zone. If anybody has any thoughts, details, comments, please come find me.
Cliff Cross, Town of Breck. Like Nina said, we're also working with the Summit County Blue River Watershed Group to do our wildfire ready action plan. And we're also in our very, very early stages of redoing our comprehensive plan.
I have no real updates from ERC.
Great.
Pete Wadden, Town of Vail, tracking a lot of the stuff happening at the state, including the MS4 and the SB 2405 stuff. But one that hasn't been mentioned is, I believe at the June 10th Water Quality Control Division meeting, they updated the state MMI standards for aquatic invertebrate population tracking, which has implications for Gore Creek. So we're very interested to find out how that impacts our 303D listing on Gore Creek when that goes into effect, I believe, at the end of the year. On a kind of cooler note, we're working on a collaborative plan with the Vail Golf Club to, we're calling it a Gore Creek Vegetation Master Plan at the Golf Club, to kind of try to get the town-owned golf course to play a little bit better with the creek ecosystem. So that's one of the things that I'm doing that I'm really enjoying and looking forward to right now, trying to figure out how to make a golf course in a mountain community not just a net negative for the creek ecosystem. I think that's all.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, this is Kaylee with Grant County. I'll just add that, like everyone else has said, or a couple other counties, that we are also working on a wildfire-ready watershed plan as well. And we are in phase two. We should wrap up with our plan in this fall, and then we'll be in the same boat as you, is trying to find money to fund the projects. So, yeah.
It'll be a duel.
Yeah. nothing specifically for Town of Avon right now, but for the Eagle River Coalition, we're just moving forward with our Beyond Lawn program, which we did in conjunction with the Eagle County Conservation District through a grant through CWCB. And so we're taking that to the next phase. Conservation District got a mill levy passed where they actually have a funding source now, which can really help expand some of the programs for removal of non-functional turf. One thing we did do is Eva contacted our planner, and we just updated our landscape regs, and we just made sure that we're incorporating SB5 issues into our new landscape plans, et cetera.
Well, she's got her own. She's somebody. She carries her own microphone. There we go. Hi, everyone. I'm April from Rudai Water and Power Authority. So we're the coalition of the local governments in the Roaring Fork watershed. So everything from Aspen down to Glenwood Springs, including the counties. And two updates, I think, from our area. One is that we have been working to soft launch a new aquatic nuisance species education and outreach campaign. You know, like all reservoirs in the state, at Rudai Reservoir, we have a boat decontamination and inspection station.
However, with the discovery of mussels in Highline Reservoir, which is near the state line, and then upstream in the Colorado River, the Roaring Fork watershed has been thinking hard about the threat that is persisting, not just through motorized watercraft, but potentially through recreational crafts. And so rafts, paddleboards, kayaks, fishing boats, things like that. And so we have been working together as a watershed to come up with a more targeted education and outreach campaign for those types of recreationalists, and have been working with CPW and gotten the installation of a couple of new, cleaning stations to put at boat ramps. And so those have been installed recently, and CPW has some new catchy campaigns related to ANS. I don't know if you all have seen them, but one is "Don't be a pain in the ANS" or "I'm a pain in the ANS" or something like that. Really cute and catchy. The other one is, what's that? Oh, Shell No. That one. Thank you. Yeah. So cute campaigns. If you're looking to promote something like that in your area, go to CPW, and we're working. They have the taglines ready. We're trying to push them hard to get them on to some swag so that we can start issuing that in our area. So that's one update. And then the second is that, just the anticipation of a really hot, dry summer again. I know that the forecasts have been that we might have a good monsoon season, but these last 2 months have been super hot. And because of that, the forecasts from the Bureau about Rudai Reservoir were way, way off. So Rudai won't fill this year. I imagine that's going to be true for other reservoirs as well. In these hot, dry summers, we have a big issue in the Roaring Fork where they begin to implement fishing closures on the Colorado and in the Eagle before they do it for our watershed, because we're a little cooler in so many ways. But those fishing closures, they do come our way as well for good reason, but because they close first on the Colorado and the Eagle, then all of the recreational pressure gets pushed into the Roaring Fork watershed. So in addition to dealing with the stress caused by the temperature, we're dealing with stress to our aquatic life caused by recreationalists and that pressure. And so it's just something that we as watershed groups, local governments have been thinking about for a long time and trying to come up with some creative options for how to address that. And one of the ways that we did that successfully a few years ago was increasing releases out of Rudai Reservoir to try to decrease temperatures in the lower Roaring Fork. And that was successful. And I imagine we'll be implementing something similar to that again this year. So anticipating that coming. Okay, thanks.
I just would like to add, when April was talking about being cooler, for those of you who don't regularly come to these meetings, she was one of the founding members of the Cool Women in Hot Water.
An organization established by Barb.
As Outkast would say, what's cooler than being cool? That's right, baby. All right. Elle, so glad to see you. We were doing a couple updates. I was wondering if you had any updates to share on behalf of the speaker.
Yeah, sure. Sorry, I had to kind of mute myself and step away for a second because I was on a phone call with her, actually. But I am back. And so, yes, happy to be here virtually, at least. I think Senator Roberts, I'm so glad he showed up today because he touched on a lot of the major updates that I think the speaker would have given, the legislative work that was done specifically on water this past session, particularly relating to that water supply measurement and forecasting program that we're hoping to really make cohesive statewide, and then also generating some more funds for water conservation through the sports betting revenue. I think generally just, I will say, if there's anything that our office can ever be of support with, please don't hesitate to reach out to us. We are here to be a resource to all of you. I think you all know that. We see a lot of your names come through our inbox on a regular basis, which is fantastic. But yeah, just don't hesitate to reach out. I know there was some discuss of some public lands resolutions countywide at the countywide level. The speaker co-sponsored a bipartisan public lands resolution during the legislative session. So if it would be helpful to chat with us about that in any capacity or anything related to public lands, please don't hesitate to let us know. And I think, beyond that, the speaker did a lot of work just in the past month or so, very focused on water and the environment. She was at the State of the River event for the Blue River. She was at the State of the Yampa, which was fantastic, did a water education tour down near Durango. So water's definitely been top of mind for her, as it kind of always is. But I think Senator Roberts touched on most of the legislative stuff from this past session. A lot of that speaker co-sponsored alongside Senator Roberts. But yeah, reach out if you ever need anything from us or if you have any questions or need some resources.
Thanks, Elle. And please send our thanks to the speaker on our behalf. So if there isn't any additional updates or any other good business for the sake of the order, I'm happy and thrilled to give you back a couple more minutes of your day. I guess, right? Yeah. Okay. Well, if there's nothing else, thank you so much for everything. Thank you to all of our consultant and our staff, Anna, Ashley, Tori, Barb. We appreciate you guys more than you know. And maybe grab a sandwich on your way out because there's lots of leftovers. Thank you, everyone online. We will see you next time.
Hi, everybody. Thank you.